coming to Parliament to do his inaugural presentation to the committee, because he's now going to become a professor. He's going to be called Professor Lansbury, no more Dr. Lansbury. So we agree that in doing so, you will come to Parliament to present his lecture, so that you can see whether what the professorship from the Faculty Association or from the university. Honorable members, we've asked some people to come and discuss with us their assessment. And I must say up front that we allowed them open space to look at our foreign policy from different angles. We didn't want to confine them to a specific understanding. But we said to them they must look at the South Africa's foreign policy and look at it and say, are we achieving what we set ourselves to achieve, and are we providing the necessary resources for us to achieve what we needed to achieve? So what I thought we'll then do, we will allow Dr. Zondi, I'm sure he's here. Dr. Zondi, you're welcome. And Dr. Lansbury to lead us to make the two presentations following each other. And then we engage in discussion. We have asked COSATU to come and make a presentation so that we can also engage with how COSATU see the international relations and the obligation the country has as one of the biggest federations in this country, to then understand as they continue to engage, because I know that they share one thing with Honorable Gibson. They were all thrown out of Zimbabwe, both of them. So we felt that they should come and share with us their own perspective and to some extent, Zanko. And we've asked the Human Science Research Council to also engage with us on these issues. I must say that I had the opportunity to meet one of their researchers in Palestine, and it was quite interesting the issues she was raising in their work as the Human Science Research Council, how they see South Africa's foreign policy vis-à-vis Israel, Palestine, and what is it that they think we should be doing. So we thought that they would also play a critical role in discussing with us to see to what extent are we able to engage with this. I'm hoping that after this process, we will then have a meeting sometime next week where we have asked the department to come and respond to some of the issues that they will be raised in this meeting. And probably from that meeting, then the portfolio committee must decide how do we deal with issues of the budget vote. The budget vote will be on the 29th. And I am aware, and I'm raising this deliberately because I am aware that when the DG came to present the budget vote, there were issues that he indicated to us that when approaching Treasurer, they were not able to persuade them. So we might have to have some time amongst ourselves as members of the portfolio committee as to how we deal with our own budget vote on the 29th. And what is it that we think. Having listened, of course, to their responses and having listened, we are hoping to get Treasury on the meeting of the 16th. We are hoping to get Treasury to come in and also enlighten us as to how they make considerations when they do budget allocations, particularly if they decide not to fund housing in the United Nations, how that decision gets made. I mean, would be one of the obvious things that they needed to make sure that we house the United Nations family properly. But if they decide not to allocate funding for that, maybe they will give us an insight that we don't have. Dr. Lansbury, Professor Lansbury, or both of them, Mr. Lansbury, Honorable Lansbury, thank you.
I was getting excited there for a moment when you said that COSATU and Mr. Gibson have something in common. I thought you were going to break the news that one of them decided to join the other. But of course you disappointed us. We'll wait for it. No, I'm sure they will join you, Mr. Gibson. Colleagues, let me Let me do two things. Let me start by just briefly suggesting a framework on the basis of which I think we should assess the upcoming budget vote speech, and suggest to you that foreign policy has indeed become predictable. There is a very clear framework that I think we can use to measure South Africa's foreign policy and look at the commitments made within the context of that framework. Well, I'm really going to spend a brief moment on that. But then I'm going to spend the bulk of my time focusing on one aspect of South Africa's foreign policy, which I believe has become the most dominant aspect of our foreign policy. I'm going to try and unpack for us the African agenda. What is South Africa's agenda? How we should understand it? And what are the obligations, both financial and political, within that African agenda that we could use to assess that agenda? And I want to share with you that the reason why I chose the African agenda as my point of departure, as opposed to the overall foreign policy, is that the next 2 months, I wish to suggest to you, is going to be dominated, certainly from an official foreign policy point of view, is going to be dominated by the century-old debate in Africa, which is now coming to an apex, the debate around which integration model Africa should pursue. And I want to share with you that during the upcoming AU summit in Accra, Ghana, there's only one issue on the agenda, namely the so-called African Union government debate. I would predict to you what I think South Africa's position is, but I will throw out a lot of financial and political challenges for us within the context of our position on the so-called United States of Africa, African Union government, or what I call in the paper, African continentalism debate. That's why I chose the African agenda. Let me start with that framework, and I'll be very brief. I really wish to suggest to you that as people who follow South Africa's foreign policy closely, that I think something remarkable happened between the period 1998 and 2007, the last 9 years, almost a decade. It's very interesting that the current commissioner of the South African Police Services, who used to be the Director General, in 1998 he set out a challenge for South Africa's foreign policy. He said South Africa's foreign policy should become predictable. I want to suggest to you that if nothing else, South Africa's foreign policy has become predictable. You might disagree with the elements of that foreign policy, but it has certainly become predictable. And I think our foreign policy essentially rests on 7 pillars that I want to throw out to you. First and foremost, something we have to do a lot of work on as analysts, this committee, the foreign affairs establishment in particular, especially if you want to make the case for more resources towards foreign policy. We're going to have to become more disciplined about making the link between domestic goals and objectives and priorities and foreign affairs. Every single foreign policy document you read today, you either have the president, the deputy ministers, the minister herself, saying that our foreign policy is there to pursue very specific domestic goals, notably addressing the challenges of the second economy, job creation, poverty alleviation. Now, I want to suggest to you that that is often stated, but it's not proven, that our foreign policy indeed pursues those domestic goals. And I think this committee should hold the department's feet to the fire more to make a more cogent argument around the link between domestic priorities and foreign policy goals. We state them. We said that foreign policy pursues domestic goals, but I think sometimes we're not really disciplined in making that case very strongly. We know, for example, just one example, that economic imperatives of foreign policy is now a very key one, where foreign officials, notably abroad and notably in the, those based in the industrialized countries, should attract investment to the country, market opportunities, make the case for official development assistance, not only to South Africa, but especially to the rest of the continent and the South. But I think we should set benchmarks on how much investment we want to attract and are we meeting this. And I just, so just to give you that. So the first element is, in fact, the link between domestic and foreign policy. Secondly, the African agenda looms large in South Africa's foreign policy. And at the risk of being slightly provocative, I wish to suggest to you that our African agenda is not often the same as other African countries' African agenda. There are serious differences. Our agenda is not always even strictly the agenda of the African Union. But South Africa has a very clear African agenda that I'm going to try and unpack this morning. Second element. The third one that I find very interesting, and I hope Dr. Zondi, without putting him on the spot, will say something about it. But I think the third element really gives for me identities to South Africa in world politics at the moment. The South-South cooperation strategy in South Africa's foreign policy. I think all sorts of debates, including the controversial vote in Myanmar, on Myanmar in the United Nations Security Council, cannot be explained unless you look at South Africa's South-South ambitions. South Africa believes that ultimately it gets its identity and status in world politics as playing a lead role as a country from the developing South. So that's a very important one. The fourth element, North-South partnership. And here I wish to suggest to you that there is no other African country. Sorry to be so immodest in my presentation. There is no other African country which takes the notion of developing partnerships between the industrialized North and Africa as seriously as South Africa. That if there's one contribution you can say the country has made, it has almost single-handedly put the idea of partnership between North and South on the agenda. And this partnership, it must be understood, is based on a trade-off between the G8 in particular, the Northern powers in general, and Africa. That Africa, through South Africa strategy, expects the G8 and the North to become better on five elements, higher levels of aid, more predictable levels of aid, market access, a fairer trade regime, notably the Doha Round, debt relief, and resources for Africa's peace support operations capacities. But something we don't talk enough about is that the G8 also harbors ambitions and expectations from Africa. That Africa must become better at good governance, rooting out corruption, addressing conflicts on the continent, create the conditions for economic takeoff. So there's a partnership based on a trade-off. The next element is South Africa's got a very ambitious global governance agenda, notably the reform of multilateral institutions, both the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, but indeed the United Nations and in particular the Security Council. And then I would say that something we don't talk enough about, that I think this committee should do, is do we put in place the necessary mechanisms at home to execute a very ambitious foreign policy agenda? And I must say, I'm trying to worry about our capacities to execute this foreign policy agenda. Just to give you one example, you cannot hope to be the foremost peacemaker in Africa, which our foreign policy clearly seeks to do, unless we become better at languages in this country. For me, it was almost understandable that our mission in Cote d'Ivoire was going to at some point run into problems based on the basic elements like, are we able, as mediators, to communicate to the belligerents in that conflict in an understandable, consistent basis? Do we speak Portuguese? Do we speak French? Do we build the capacity? Do we speak Swahili? And yes, we want to be the foremost peacemaker in the continent. Well, this is a basic element where we can ask the Foreign Service Institute, in particular Foreign Affairs in general, what are you doing about that basic skill in order to become better at executing your foreign force? So those are basically the flavor knowledge. But let me briefly go to the African agenda. And let me start by locating the African agenda within the context of the current debate. I want to be bold and make a prediction for you. We're going to return from Accra, Ghana. And for want of a better phrase, the Mbeki camp is going to prevail in Accra, Ghana. I want to suggest to you that the debate around the African Union government is essentially a debate which is essentially a hope about what kind of integration model should Africa pursue. There's a pan-Africanism debate that is a century old, started, of course, in 1900 and spearheaded by pan-Africanists like W.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey and so on. But in the year 2007, this debate is coming to a head. And there are essentially three models on the table that will be debated in Accra, Ghana, where every African head of state must take a stand on this issue. There is first and foremost what you can call the pan-Africanists, who is in favor of a United States of Africa, a single confederation of African states, and that is spearheaded by President Gaddafi, the brother leader, President Museveni from Uganda, and somebody's eyes started to find very puzzling on this debate. Outgoing Nigerian President Obasanjo has joined that camp. And there are one or two other states, but that's really the extent of this group. They are in favor of this federation of African states, where you have a supranational African state, where states will essentially become federations. The second grouping, and by the way, the outgoing chair of the AU Commission, Alpha Konari, also supports that group, but he is at pains to tell us he does so in his personal capacity. The majority of states are in favor of what I call in the paper of continental Africanism. Not pan-Africanism, but continental Africanism. I suggest to you that President Mbeki is in the forefront of this debate. Let me also make a very interesting observation for you. SADC is the only region going to Accra in early July with a unanimous position on this debate. The only region. In West Africa, they are split. In North Africa, they are split. In East Africa, there are splits where President Kikwete of Tanzania is more careful. President Kibaki of Kenya is more careful. But President Museveni is clearly with the other group. SADC, all 14 states, are going with a unanimous position that I'll get to in a moment. But they are in favor of a gradualist consolidation process where you essentially strengthen the current African Union institutions, all of them, the Assembly, the Executive Council, the Peace and Security Council, the Commission in particular, the Pan-African Parliament, ECOSOC, the African Court of Human and People's Rights. They are in favor of consolidation, strengthening these institutions. They're going there with a unanimous position. Before I forget, there's one downside that I want to suggest to you that South Africa must be very careful about. South Africa is, as far as I'm concerned, developing a reputation that its rhetoric is very progressive, pro-integration and everything, but in reality, it is conservative. And some countries will hit at South Africa, I predict, by saying that you are actually the obstacle to integration. They see us as a reluctant integrator. I believe government has a strategy that I'll try and unpack in a moment. But let me go to the African agenda basically. So I'm suggesting to you that this notion of building continental order among states, as opposed to Russia and the United States of Africa, sums up South Africa's African agenda. It wishes to bring order among 53 members of the AU, 54 African states, because Morocco is not a member because of the dispute over the Western Sahara. But I want to suggest to you that the African agenda essentially rests on five pillars. One, there is a domestic dimension. The domestic dimension essentially says you can't be an island of stability in a region of instability. You have to get involved in peacemaking missions, peace support operations missions. You have to stabilize the continent to become an attractive market. You have to search for economic opportunities in Africa. So there's a domestic dimension to it. I think if they really want to persuade Trevor Manuel for more resources, the department will have to become better at making this link between external adventures and domestic realities. And I think the Department of Defense was 7-8 years ago in a similar position to the Department of Foreign Affairs, where on the one hand the budget gradually comes down, and on the other hand your priorities expand. And how do you therefore do more with less resources? They become better at making the case for resources, and I'm speaking under correction, but I wouldn't be surprised if currently the Department of Defense and the SANDF get as much as 1.7% of GDP goes to defense. Now this is a different story from 8 years ago. 8 years ago, their budget was also declining. At the moment, they're escalating. Of course, they can show that we have peacekeeping obligations in Burundi, in the DRC, in Darfur, in as far afield as expecting to get involved in Cote d'Ivoire. But they managed to get more resources. And I think this department is struggling, and I think we have to make a better case for the link between domestic and foreign affairs. The second element of the African agenda is not only that the African Union is a priority, but South Africa has got a very clear policy on the African Union, namely, those institutions already established should be strengthened, and those that are not established yet, such as the African Court of Justice, should be established as a matter of course. And here I want to give you a very specific hint that you must look out for in that budget speech. I believe President Mbeki is going to Accra with the objective of countering the perception or the accusation that our rhetoric is progressive, but we are actually the stumbling block to integration, by offering to being in the forefront of making financial resources available for the consolidation of these institutions. Now, it seems to me, therefore, if that's your objective, which I think is a smart objective, by the way, you say, I'm not going to rush into the United States of Africa. I think we should consolidate what we have. But a central theme running through the concerns, certainly of the foreign policy by the political leaders of our country, which is sometimes different, I know it's a very controversial thing to say, which is different from the foreign policy of the Department of Foreign Affairs, the administrative. But I think they're going to Accra with a strategy to say, not only should institutions like the PAP be strengthened, not only should institutions like the Court of Justice be established, but we will also be in the forefront of making resources available for them. Now I can suggest that the current budget as it stands does not make room for more resources to go and strengthen these institutions, and yet that is the foreign policy strategy of the country. As it is, the budget as it stands, which stands just over 3 billion rand, I'm speaking under correction here, just over 3 billion, is unable to meet all the obligations of last year's stated goals. And yet this year, we're going to an African Union mission to make further promises of financial resources to strengthen African Union institutions. So there's a juncture between commitments made versus the resources that are being given. But in a nutshell, colleagues, South Africa is not only the first African country to have hosted the African Union. And South Africa is not only the first country that was the president of the African Union, but South Africa's priority right now, completely contrasting with Libya or Uganda or Nigeria, is we should consolidate and strengthen African Union institutions. And something that I'm sure all of us in this room can agree with, one of the crises that I think we have in Africa is we boast all sorts of progressive norms and values and principles in terms of governance, human rights, democratization, and yet we've got this crisis where African states fail to live up to the norms. So one of the other strategies that Africa is going with to Accra, I believe, is a fascinating concept of minimum adherence to continental norms and values. So Africa wants African Union institutions to become better at holding African states to live by these norms. For example, we have other electoral norms. There's absolutely no guarantee that any other election plan right now is done in line with regional norms. So we've got continental and regional norms, but at the national level they're not taken seriously. Third element, which is very, very, very important, and this is actually what separates the Mbeki, Kikwete, John Kufo came. I find Ghana a very interesting player at the moment. President Kufo is currently in the country, and I happened to attend the opening of the PAP yesterday when he spoke. He feels attacked. He feels that given the legacy of Kwame Nkrumah, the foremost proponent of the United States of Africa, he feels that Ghana is almost historically linked to that dimension. But I can tell you that the current administration in Ghana is more aligned to the continentals as opposed to the United States of Africa. He believes in the building of institutions, the building of norms, and the like. But what really sets this group apart from the United States of Africa group is the third element. Sub-regional bodies as the building blocks of the African Union. What they're essentially saying is there are five designated regions of the continent. North Africa, West Africa, East Africa and the Horn, Central Africa and Southern Africa. And each one of them has a premier integration body. In Southern Africa is SADC. In Central Africa is ECAC, the Economic Community of Central African States. In East Africa there are two actually. Three. There's COMESA. There is the emerging ECA and there's EGAD in the Horn. In North Africa is ECOWAS, and in West Africa is ECOWAS, and in North Africa is the Arab Maghreb Union. But what sets them apart is they are really going to say that we have to strengthen regional economic groups and transform regional economic groups into regional integration groups, regional integration communities, instead of rushing into a federation of African states. So the question of how you build RECs, R-E-C, is a rather unfortunate acronym, because some people believe they behave like RECs in terms of capacity constraints and the like. But how do you build them? And I can assure you, if South Africa is going to go with that position, there will be an expectation that it will back up its reform initiative for SADC with making greater resources available for SADC. So again, there is a juncture between commitments and expectations versus what is made available. The fourth element, and then I'm beginning to conclude, Chair, the fourth element is, of course, NEPAD, the New Partnership for Africa's Development, which South Africa believes is the genuine socio-economic development plan of Africa. It's, of course, based on a strict, crude growth strategy. I have to warn you, that we have to be careful about that NEPAD is seen in many parts of the continent as the extension of South Africa's domestic macroeconomic strategy. I think all things it's good to have those perceptions. It's not shared by everybody as the undisputed socio-economic development plan, but the real strength of NEPAD continues to be this notion that you can't have development without peace, of peace without development. So what has left apart from previous development plans of the continent is that it introduces governance and democracy as prerequisites for economic development. Hence the EPRM. Let me make this one point to you about the EPRM. I'm sure some of you will not on this point. South Africa regards the EPRM as the model to promote governance in the continent. But there is a lot of disquiet, certainly amongst the panel of eminent members of the EPRM, about the tensions around South Africa's own EPRM process. My own view, for what it's worth, is that I see civil society and government equally messed up on the process. But there's a perception that, again, that our government talks the great talk on the EPRM, but the way it tries to manipulate the governance of the process does not bode well. And they feel it's unfortunate that South Africa's own EPRM was marred in so much controversy. I conclude with South Africa's peace and security obligations. What sets this administration apart from its predecessor is that, with the exception of the intervention in Lesotho, the Nelson Mandela government was predisposed towards peacemaking. The current government is willing to back up peacemaking with huge resources for peacekeeping, and it comes at a huge financial tag. And there's a great expectation that South Africa would back up peacekeeping with greater resources. And here's the question that I would pose to the Department of Foreign Affairs after the budget speech. One, how financially are you ready to take on more peacekeeping obligations? But more importantly, what are our own human resource constraints? And I must tell you one thing. I think we are becoming very overstretched when it comes to both mediation efforts and to actual peacekeeping operations. I wonder whether we have the personnel, the armed personnel, to really engage in more peacekeeping operations. But here's what I'm concerned about our peacemaking operations. I think our peacemaking, our diplomacy, depends too much on the head of state and senior politicians in government, and I'm concerned that South Africa is not institutionalizing a peacemaking, a diplomacy, a preventive diplomacy capacity. Given the nature of our subsidiaries, CODESA, where many of you participated in, are we really institutionalizing a mediation capacity that does not rely so much on the head of state, the former deputy head of state, minister, deputy ministers of foreign affairs, and key foreign affairs officials? Are we really as a country building a genuine peacemaking capacity that relies on other characters? And that's one of the concerns I have. Finally, colleagues, I conclude with the notion of partnership. The one thing I want to suggest to you is that where I started off is that South Africa really set itself apart by being the negotiator of global partnerships for Africa. They are contained in the Jade Africa Partnership Agreement of 2002. South Africa takes the Millennium Development Goals very seriously as a partnership between North and South. There is the Monterrey Consensus of 2003. South Africa is the only country who next Wednesday will be anointed by the European Union as a strategic partner of the EU. No other country in the continent enjoys that. And there is a recognition of South Africa's continental role, this agenda, and South Africa's global role. Year two, I'm concerned about our capacity to hold Africans, fellow Africans, and ourselves to account for our side of the bargain, and more importantly, to hold the G8 and others accountable to the bargain. So in a nutshell, I conclude with this thought. I'm becoming concerned about a growing gap I perceive between an ambitious foreign policy ambitious goals, clearly stated goals, but a growing gap in our abilities to implement that ambitious goal from a financial point of view, from a human resource capacity point of view, and indeed even from an infrastructure, diplomatic infrastructure point of view. My last sentence, and I know it wasn't part of my brief, but I really want, I've been waiting for an opportunity to say this, so let me use this forum to say it. I think South Africa's foreign policy has become so predictable that after 2009, there will not be many changes in foreign policy. That there will be a continuation of foreign policy, of this agenda. If there will be changes, it will be changes in style, but not in the overall substance of foreign policy. So the questions about resources and capacity is not going to go away in 2009. They will remain as they are. I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Landsberg. He took us a step further and is making predictions for 2009, assuming that the government then will be the same government party. So we still have to go through elections to arrive at that. And that's the issue. What I thought we will do, we will take Dr. Zondi's presentation and we'll just bring them together as one discussion and we break for lunch, which will make life easy. Because I'm worried that if we break them, there might be other questions that he might pick up and actually answer them in his presentation. So that we take them both and then we break for lunch after we've gone through that. I'm not sure whether members will agree with me. That's the problem of the chair.
Could I just ask you a question, Chair? What's your ending time of this meeting? After lunch and after question, what time are you preparing?
We thought that after lunch we'll have an hour. We have the two last presentations after lunch and we should have done. So I'm told that we should be finished by 3. At most, including lunch and everything. Unless the members suggest otherwise, that we because the lunch was going to be about what, an hour, and then we can cut the lunch. The kitchen suggests that we actually cut the lunch by half, so that then we can end up by 2:30 at most, so we can finish the meeting at 2:30. I assume that we've agreed. Dr. Zondi is running short of power. Apparently, he needs power to present before the portfolio committee.
Four places of power.
So I think it's halfway there. So do you want to speak again?
No, up to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to raise some questions, take a critical look at how we are actually conducting our foreign policy, to share our thoughts in terms of how we are doing and what we might want to consider going forward. Again, like Professor Chris Landsberg, to provide you with a set of conceptual questions that you might want to raise when the budget vote comes before you. What I'm going to do is, given the open mandate that we're given, is to go through various elements of our foreign policy and the conduct thereof, and kind of point you to certain things that in our day-to-day observation of the conduct of foreign policy, we think there are challenges to be dealt with, or there are certain positives that are coming out, and all of that. So you might find that it is a bit disorganized, but I follow the structure of the written foreign policy. So we find that a lot of things that I say, Professor Landsberg would have already said them. And I think that's a disadvantage of being the second one in line, and especially talking after Chris, who tends to be very broad and the vacuum cleans everything. I will try and point out some of the few things that he might have left out as he vacuumed the whole ground. I'm glad he had a limitation of time, so he couldn't complete everything, then I end up being useless. Let me say, I was starting some of the conceptual questions, you know, some of the things that guide my own thinking about foreign policy in South Africa, or my own assessment, you know, why do I anchor it on? You know, a lingering question that has always been in my mind, and the mind of a number of observers of how we've conducted foreign policy is what is actually our ultimate value? What is actually our fundamental goal in terms of foreign policy, vis-à-vis our general, what in political philosophy they call supreme values, you know, our general goals, our lofty goals, our goals about the world, our goals about Africa. What is our goal in South Africa with regards to this? Well, what is there for South Africa in our pursuit of foreign policy? Are we actually constantly conscious of what we're actually trying to do? In all the little things that we're doing, you know, in a wide variety of areas, are we conscious about what is it that we actually do? And is the department, or the leadership of the department, actually keenly aware of what it is that we are actually trying to do? Because there is a danger of subverting our own self-interest in this pursuit of these internationalist ideals, of these idealistic things, idealistic internationalist agenda and all of that. And there is a danger that if we do not get that clearly articulated, that our domestic stakeholders may misunderstand what we are trying to do as a department, and that you might find ourselves under pressure from the domestic constituencies over how we conduct our international policies, over whether we are focused too much in international issues at the expense of domestic issues, because they do not see themselves in how we are conducting our international policy. We appear to be charitable. We appear to be doing it for the region, to be doing it for the continent, doing it for the world. But it's not clear what is in it for South Africa. And the point that was raised by Chris earlier, this balance between this idealism and realism, in this case used in a more colloquial manner, meaning this idealism, this lofty goals and capacity to deliver on them. So we constantly ask ourselves, how realistic are our goals? And therefore, how realistic are our programs? How realistic are those set of programs that are listed in the strategic plan for 2006, 2009, and the recent one, the revised one, 2007, 2009? It's an interesting one. It plays itself out in a number of areas. For example, who are our strategic partners? How strategic are these partners? What is the convergence of values, principles, and goals with them? Every time I ask this question, I keep remembering how we saw Nigeria when we intervened in Cote d'Ivoire. When we were invited by Nigeria as the chair of the African Union to intervene or mediate in Cote d'Ivoire. I keep fearing whether we are going to see the same situation and the invitation for us to mediate in Zimbabwe. Because what happened in Cote d'Ivoire is that Nigeria had a specific interest that it wanted South Africa to push and secure. And the best way to do that is to give a mediator a very strict and narrow framework of mediation, which was to unblock the obstacle. Not to look at the fundamental questions that Cote d'Ivoire is facing, fundamental issues that may need to be discussed in order to make a breakthrough in Cote d'Ivoire. As a result, we were able to sign a number of peace agreements, Pretoria 1, Pretoria 2, Pretoria 3, but they seem never to work. And then Burkina Faso comes and puts away all that agenda, the Minas Makusi framework and all of that. In a spare of a month, they make a breakthrough. The rebels are in government, a government of nationality is in power. It seems to me that we took for granted that Nigeria has our interest. Our interest was to make sure that there's permanent peace in Cote d'Ivoire. Our interest was to make sure that there is a turn in the situation in Cote d'Ivoire. But I'm not quite sure if those who gave us the mandate, Nigeria, as the chair of the AU, as a powerful player in ECOWAS, were actually meaning the same. This is why at a point when we thought we had done the whole work and we were about to do the last things and then celebrate a victory, and then Nigeria takes it away from us. The sidelines of the UN, great UN summit on UN reform in September last year, Nigeria convened an emergency ECOWAS meeting to discuss South Africa's mediation, actually to take it away from South Africa and say, no, thank you for doing it well. And then it turns out the chair of ECOWAS, which is President Tanja of Niger, did not know about the meeting. Chair of ECOWAS does not know about the meeting, but there is a meeting to discuss South African mediation. And at that point, it is headed over to the UN and ECOWAS. ECOWAS as the implementing agency. At that point, Nigeria felt they had achieved their goals. They had secured their interests. There are about 1 million Nigerians who are refugees from the Biafran war, who were in Cote d'Ivoire, that needed to be kept there. So South Africa had used its resources, used its diplomatic capital to try and delay a process that might have hurt Nigeria. So in the end, Nigeria takes it away to South Africa, and then ECOWAS gets accolade for making a breakthrough, which is what you see today. It's at a time when there were supposed to be UN votes, UN positions on on UN reform, and South Africa and Nigeria were competing for a UN security seat, possible UN security seat. So those are some of the questions that come to mind. Let me move on. In terms of global governance, I'm just going to comment on different areas. Global governance agenda. I mean, our foreign policy is very strong on our global governance agenda, and as Chris said, I can't see an African country that has such a clear idea of what we want to do with global governance. We want to do basically four things. One is to reform the political power and architecture. That translates to the reform of the UN, especially UN Security Council, but also the UN management system itself, UN bureaucracy. We also want to promote multilateralism through all the platforms that we have, as part of transforming or reforming that whole political power structure. The second part is to reform the financial institutions. We are clear that we want to embark on this tricky endeavor to reform the manner in which the IMF and the World Bank are governed and the manner in which they also deploy their power on the continent and everywhere in the world. Tricky because we are demanding democracy from an institution that is run on the basis of stakeholder interests, those who contribute to its financial viability. And we are doing so, it's tricky also because IMF has anticipated this kind of push that South Africa is very critical in, and has allowed the proliferation of other more private similar institutions such as the export credit agencies. We hear that, you know, the indebtedness of Africa is worse under this export credit agency than it was under IMF and World Bank. So those are crept in to advance the same agenda that the IMF is doing. But when we're concentrating on IMF, these things are proliferating. All major countries in the world, developed countries in the world, are using them. A third area, I've lost power. I'm disempowered. I thought I was going to get power before. I've lost it. That's a problem with technology. And I don't have a printed copy of this thing. But yeah. I'll see how far it can continue to go. I think Chris alluded to also this idea of consolidating or I think rebuilding the South agenda, global South agenda. For me, I keep asking myself, for what? What is our fundamental paradigm for that one? Is it a developmental one? Is it a combination of democracy and development? Is it about creating leverages for bargaining our global agenda? Is it a combination of all of these things? But it's never really clear what is it that lies behind our pursuit for a global consolidation of the global South agenda. What is it? What is in there? Because if we're clear about what is it, then we'll be clear about who our strategic partners are. And so on. And I think I think also we need some clarity as to which platforms are we using for that. You get a sense that we are using IPSA, but we still want to keep NAM. We still also want to be very active in driving the G20, the G77, but it's not very clear whether we have picked out of all those as to which ones are most fundamental and very strategic to our agenda. I'm not sure, I'm not getting a sense of what is our institutional modality for advancing our global South agenda. On one hand, IPSA is a very useful one. Politically, it's giving an interesting body of views on issues that are global. But I can't help thinking that, you know, soon we would have to judge it also on its propensity to provide economic dividends for any of the three countries. Because right now, what you find is that IPSA has been growing and it's very strong, and this year we're hosting the third IPSA summit and all of that, but there's no trade to show out of that. The trade between the three countries remains the same, and in some cases, such as in Brazil,
it is sliding down. So it's purely political.
Was it at that?
At that level. What can we show out of this?
That would give as a justification for its consolidation, for keeping it and using it as a platform.
I think this talks to our ability within the department to make use of these platforms that are well thought out, that are well meant to make sure that we leverage our interests in a much more clear way. That we are very clear about what outcomes we want to see out of this. And all of that. One of the big challenges, this IPSA, for example, includes South Africa, India, and Brazil. But we also have binational commissions with these three countries that seem to duplicate the same idea. And it makes it very difficult for us to measure whether we are actually getting what we're inventing out of the IPSA process. I think when we... Also, in this idea of the global South agenda, I think our choice of strategic partners followed by requisite resource mobilization and working on them should help us to make sure that we get something out of it. But I don't see that. I can't easily match our choice. I cannot see our strategic partners in the manner in which we invest our resources in this critical southern power. We seem to be investing the same amount of diplomatic, human, and financial capital in servicing our relations with Thailand as we do with Singapore. Yet they are very similar in terms of what they have to bring for us. Or bring to our global South agenda. I think we have to be very clear in terms of what we want to how we want to push our agenda by choosing our strategic partners in a very clear way. Not everybody should be our strategic partner. That's one of the crises of our policy. That it's now very difficult to tell who is strategic and who is not strategic. We have binational commissions with over 40 countries. But if you look in the right through the world, that binational commissions are actually usually reserved for elevated bilateral relations. And then we leave everything else to normal diplomatic missions. But we have binational commissions with actually every country that we can think of. And it is very... Many of them are not functioning. Many of them are just annual meetings. Some of them have stopped functioning at all, such as the South Korean one. It's being revived now, but it stopped functioning at some point. Some of them do not have an agenda. And then you sense that if you look across the board, look at this 42 or something, BNCs that we have, the agenda is cut and paste. The agenda for this one is completely similar to that one, but these two countries may not have the same cooperative strength, but we have the same. Almost like a one-size-fits-all approach to them. In terms of the North-South agenda, which is another pillar for our international relations, the FA strategic plans, for example, and in many of their presentations, we have pegged the GH, the EU, our relations with the EU, and our relations with the OECD for leveraging our African agenda. But I keep asking myself, how do we balance our own agenda in those relationships and the continental agenda? Or are we assuming that our agenda is the agenda for Africa? And then at some point also I think we have to be realistic and say the AU itself will have to develop its own capacity to leverage an African agenda. An African agenda is an AU agenda. The AU is the institutional modality, the institutional mechanism for advancing the African agenda. But I think at that point, when the AU, for example, has its own embassy at the UN, which is something that has been under discussion for the past 4 years,
not heaven.
But the AU had its own embassy or a diplomatic office in the EU. Then it allows us to support the AU rather than to champion an AU agenda. Because it's fraught all sorts of challenges. Because then you get accused for advancing your own interests in the name of the AU. And so I think that would have to be, you need to think about it. And I don't see what we say about our relationship with the U.S. in the strategic plan. I mean, we may look at it. I've looked at it three times already. I don't see what we're saying about the U.S. Yet the U.S. is a critical player. It's an important player. We may not like them. We may not think they're our best friends. But they are a giant that you need to find a way to determine how you want to dance with them. Because they have a serious impact on our peace diplomacy. They have an impact on our developmental agenda in the continent, an impact on Nepal. For example, if you look at AGOA, what are we saying about AGOA? We've been very silent about it. But it has a capacity to undercut Nepal. It has a capacity to undercut our regional economic community agenda. And so on. I think we also have to identify some of the key players in terms of the global agenda in the North that have an impact on the continent that we may not want to relate that much with them. The French, we have to accept that the French control about a quarter of Africa. We have to know what we want to do with the French. How we want to relate with them, how we want to build a relationship with them that manages their impact on the continent. In many ways, South Africa's interventions in the DRC, in Rwanda, and also in Cote d'Ivoire were undermined by our failure to know how to relate to France. You will remember that in the middle of our mediation in Cote d'Ivoire, Jacques Chirac said, South Africa does not understand this region. It's not an element. It's our region. You cannot resolve the issues of Francophone Africa unless you relate, you find a way of engaging the French. South Africa went there and said, we're going to talk to the Ivorians. We're not going to talk to the Jews. Don't talk to the Ivorians because you think Ivorians know what they want to do. And then you found that it never got moving because the real interests, the real power brokers in the area, where the French, and if you don't get them on board, it's not going to work. Nigerians, if you don't get them on board, we are never going to get movement. Burkina Faso, which has about a quarter of the Ivorian population coming from it, which fears that a resolution of the situation that they do not control might lead to a lot of Burkinabe moving back to Burkina Faso and causing untold damage to its own economy. We're not going to allow South Africa to move, and on all of those kinds of things. But what I'm saying is that we need to say, the department needs to say, what is it that they want to do with regard to the French policy in Africa. More than any other country, the French policy in Africa is really seriously embedded. A number of African heads of state, everybody knows, it's an open secret, get their cue from Paris. How do we engage them if we do not engage their master? And all of that. A number of presidents actually have to be in France every 2 months. And now with a new administration in France under Sarkozy, who is promising to be very hesitant about Africa, who is promising to be very strategic and very selective about Africa, what is our policy in terms of capturing those spaces that France is likely to move out of? Because his criticism of Chirac was that Chirac was just too open-ended, was just too all-embracing. That is, he's going to be very selective on the basis of their own economic interests. But how are we hoping to galvanize the whole of Africa to recapture that quarter of Africa from the French? And in terms of another pillar, is the one of consolidating a global development agenda. We center it around the UN developmental agenda, the Copenhagen
agenda, the Rio agenda, the WSSC agenda, the World Food Summit agenda, and so on. And I think that is very important. I think that is very key, because UN is useful for two major things, in my view. One is for entrenching this agenda of multilateralism, but second is for putting development at the center of global politics and economics. Development, not just economic growth, but development. I think that's been a bastion for development agenda since the development decade of 1960s. If not for the UN, we would have all succumbed to the World Bank or Washington consensus on this economic growth dogma on the continent. And I think we're saying we want to leverage the MDGs in global platform, and we want to resist deviation from it. But are we prepared for the real UN to do this? What are we doing? Well, how are we doing it? As Department of Foreign Affairs, there's one small unit also on developmental issues. One very small unit. And there's no sense that it is working very closely with other departments that are more directly involved in issues of development, like social development and others. Are we really actually putting mechanisms in place to give effect to what we are saying, leveraging MDGs? How do we do it? With only that small unit comprising of three people. Within that development agenda, we also want to push the monetary finance for development agenda. And we have to establish who would be our key partners from the north, who matters most for us in terms of the agenda. And we have not come up with a position on whether the UN architecture needs to be streamlined a little bit more in terms of advancing the UN development agenda. Whether we still need to have UNICEF, UNDP, UNFF, UNFPA, and all of those things, or whether we need to advocate an amalgamation of them with a common, one strong UN developmental institutions to push the UN development agenda. So, global security, we obviously are for UN Security Council reform, and we are making some strong input into how we manage issues of proliferation of arms and issues around nuclear armament and so on. But we would have serious challenges with regard to these new issues that have been pushed into the agenda, the issue of terrorism. I do not see what we actually are saying and what is it that we actually asking for. Because one of the critical challenges that we haven't seen, probably an opportunity for us is to make sure that we manage this idea of defining, this conceptualization of the terrorism. I think there's an opportunity there, because on a Kofi Annan, the UN was saying maybe we must step back and define this terrorism. They had a working definition that came up 2 years ago, but it was not a final definition. And I'm not sure if under Bashir Moon, that debate is going to be revisited. I think South Africa may make an input into that one. I think we're calling for a more principled but strategic intervention in key hotspots, especially around the Middle East, Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, but also in Asia, North Korea, Iran, and so on, and that's guided by our goals. I think that's pretty clear. But whether we have the capacity on the ground to give effect to that is another question. Just briefly on the African agenda, because Chris has covered everything. Our primary priority with regard to AU agenda is consolidating the AU agenda. Yet we do not have people deployed at the AU. We have vacancies that South Africa was supposed to take on the AU. We have two people, as far as I remember, that are in the AU headquarters, that work for the AU. And the other players, critical players in this, have really deployed a big number, their own people in the AU. So who is going to leverage our agenda inside the AU institution? And then we and then we have a very long list of what we want to do with the AU, and it's not clear what is it, what is most critical for us in terms of this idea of consolidating the AU agenda. What is it that we want to do? I want to suggest that what you actually want to do and what should be primary for us, Chris, I don't know what happened, I can't know. What is very primary for us is to make sure that the AU develops a capacity to implement its own agenda, more than anything else. A capacity to give effect to its own decisions, to make sure that they work. And I think that's quite a challenge. Maybe at this point, let me just move further and say, I think there are also challenges around who are our strategic partners in terms of advancing the AU agenda. You know, we often assume that it's going to be Nigeria, and then Algeria, the founder members of the NEPAD process. But what are we doing to service those strategic relationships? What are we doing, for example, about one of our strategic partners who is constantly criticizing what we put together jointly, Senegal? What are we doing about that? Who is our strategic partner in Central Africa? I've asked that question, but I haven't had a clear answer to who is our strategic partner in that particular region. That is a very important region for us. Or are we creating one by strengthening DRC? We have a very shaky relationship with Gabon. Yet Gabon is a critical power in that region. I can understand the difficulty of our relationship with Cameroon, because Cameroon is a very hesitant regional powerhouse in that region. And I understand that one. While this thing is off, let me also raise issues around SADC as well. I think it's very clear what you also want to do with SADC. But I think it's not very clear what you want to do with our champion in both SADC and SACU at the same time. Especially in two years' time, our goal is to have a customs union for SADC in 2 years' time. But generally, we cannot, in terms of trade integration, we cannot have two. We cannot be a member of two customs unions at the same time. Who are we going to be a member of? Are we going to be a member of SADC? Or are we going to be a member of the SADC customs union? We're not quite sure what. So where are we investing our capital in, our influence in? Who have we picked and all of those things? And then also, we are very critical in bringing about a development plan for SADC, the Regional Indicative Strategy Development Plan. We deploy people in the SADC Secretariat to steward the process and make sure that it works. And indeed, we came up with a very interesting, very progressive developmental plan. But it is beginning to gather dust for, among other reasons, for a weak implementation capacity or coordinating capacity at the SADC Secretariat. There's a number of vacancies that are still there at a very critical area. For example, the chief director, who is supposed to be the key operational person at SADC, the position is still vacant, and a number of positions are vacant. It became vacant when South Africa, when the person that South Africa had deployed there to drive the RISGP, when his term ended, then there was no one to replace. And South Africa has not moved to place people in there. But we're here, that we are working on a secondment policy that is going to allow us to put people in there, and all of that. Just drawing to a close. In terms of this, maybe I'll get back now that I have my notes back.
went back to the AU, to the this African agenda. You know, because people have, there's a lot of debate out there. You know, I've had on more than one occasion people say, well, what has happened to Nepal? The scary question is, because it simply means there's an indication that it is fast losing its momentum. And in many ways, it's been overtaken by the APRM, partly because the donors have decided to invest in the APRM. Of course, you know, obviously, it is to advance the agenda of building democracy, checking on bad governance and violation of human rights and so on. But what has actually happened to NEPAD as our common development vision? It raises the question as to whether our decision, which was a understandable decision, to hand it over to the African continent to decide who would drive this NEPAD agenda, whether it was a wise one, whether it was time to do so, whether the players that we handed it over to had the same interest as us to champion it the manner that it was championed. It did. For all its weaknesses, there are many, but it was able at least to stimulate debate about what we want to put forward as our own development agenda and our development paradigm. It stimulated debate around how we want to link political conditions to development. I think it stimulated debate around how we want to advance this idea of regional integration for development and all of that. But it is fast disappearing. And my own sense is that, you know, though South Africa and South Africa were very reluctant to be seen as hegemons, to be seen as pushing too much and all of that, but that this problem, the problem of this nature still needs champions. You still need somebody to champion. They will need a champion. In terms of our peace diplomacy, I will echo Chris's point as to whether we are actually building peace diplomacy skills within the department. We tend to have predictably few people to steward our peace diplomacy in all sorts of areas that we want to engage in. I'm not quite sure, I may be wrong, I'm not quite sure that we are deliberately restoring or retaining that institutional memory that we have gained over the past 7 years of involvement in peace diplomacy and very successful. I worry that you might lose that in the next 4 or 5 years, as many of these people who are involved in it either retire or die. I'm not getting a sense that you are deliberately ensuring succession in that particular regard, creating our internal peace diplomacy, internal envoys, trained particularly to do so. I'm not sure if we are doing that. Are we using our former ambassadors that are critical in those particular areas to train, for example, new diplomats at the Foreign Service Institute? What are we doing to our former diplomats? Ones were very critical in this particular work. Are we proactively teaming them up with younger and more promising intelligent diplomats so that they pass on their skills? Are we developing our own, you know, conceptual, theoretical approaches to issues of peace diplomacy on the basis of our experience as a South African, a purely South African approach to these particular things? Are we engaging ourselves in internal discussions to make sure that this happens? I think, with regards, coming back now to NEPAD, where I was telling you about, one of the challenges is that not only that the implementation capacity of SADC is missing, partly due to the manner in which the region has handled institutional transformation, and I accept that it should take time, but there's no indication that there is serious work towards restoring that implementation capacity at SADC. appointment of citizens, politicians, to try and give it some energy and oomph, was a wise decision, but I'm not sure whether it's actually really working. I'm not sure if we have realized as a country that part of the reason SADC is not moving the way it's moving, part of the reason why it's not moving the way it's moving is that its secretariat is purely technical. It's purely to implement. And it has to implement, even implementing on its mandate, it has to constantly refer to the integrated ministerial committee. So there is a sense that the nation states, the member states, are resolutely resisting to cede any element of sovereignty to the institution itself, to give it to, so that it can actually push member states to implement what they have collectively agreed upon. So that these are the secretariat that is very lame, very weak, unable to move without referring to. Even on the appointment of chief directors, appointment of directors and all of those things. I think we have to think carefully about how we make sure that we capacitate the secretariat to do that. And there are some smaller things that we need to do. When are we establishing our national committee, the SADC National Committee, which is an implementing agency to galvanize implementation within South Africa? A number of countries have not established SADC National Committee, and we cannot champion that because we have not established our own. So it's supposed to be a multi-stakeholder body, comprising of government, business, and some participation of civil society to implement the SADC agenda. So if we do not establish this body, then the SADC agenda won't be implemented. Then the RISDP will get a last. Then we will not do it. Then we will not be able to urge others to implement SADC agenda because we have not established our own national committee. Let me end with a couple of few general points. I think the issue of participation in multilateral institutions is a very critical one. I think this can be debated, but I think countries like Nigeria, Brazil and others have gained a lot of influence out of their willingness to put their people in dedicated positions within UN, WTO, IMF, World Bank and all of these institutions. Even though that we do not like, we still need to put people in there. I think that another area I alluded to, generally, is the functionality and the efficacy of the binational commission. I think we need to revisit this idea of binational commission. To think again as to what is the reason, why do we base a decision to establish a binational commission with a country on? Do we establish this, honestly, a binational commission with Swaziland, with a country such as South Korea, when we do not actually know exactly what it is that elevates this relationship above the normal diplomatic relations and all of that? And I think the political principles that my own firm, I may be wrong, have left it to the officials to determine who we have a binational commission on. And I think by so doing, we have lost that element of strategic leadership, of being very strategic in our choice of who we have binational commissions. Take for example, the U.S. has something like 8 binational commissions. It has 2 in Southern Africa, that is with Mexico and with Brazil. And there are clear reasons for that. Mexico, by issues of, in my term, of immigration, over issues of labor, because Mexico is a source of labor for Americans, and Brazil, because it has reason that Brazil is a regional power broker. So when Brazil on your side, then it has the whole region on your side. And in Africa, it has as far as I know, only with South Africa. So it has reason. South Africa is the most strategic power in the region. The Germans have the same. They have 2 binational commissions in Africa. One with South Africa, another one with Kenya.
Radhika, because of his political position and influence, plus also the fact the economic interest for Germany, automobile industry, in Kenya, because purely of the motor industry and technology industry. That's what the product decided to do. And therefore, they invest a disproportionate amount of capital and effort and energy in this BNC over disproportionate in the sense that they invest more in there than they invest in normal diplomatic relations. Everybody else has normal diplomatic relations. But those that have BNC are those that have a serious distinct impact on their global agenda, but also on their own economic interests, self-interest and I would suggest that is a model to follow, because if you look at Russia, that's the same. They have decided that the Central Asia area, the Middle East area, are their strategic areas, and then the U.S. and the U.K. Those are the only advantages that they have. I think we have to take a cue from how they use it, so that we do not waste unnecessary resources in institutions that are not actually very strategic for our interests. Because we are by nature a bit more trading in terms of capital, energy, and so on. I think we need to take stock of our public diplomacy as well. I think one of the serious challenges, my own serious challenge with our foreign policy, is the manner in which we articulate it. This idea that we have quite diplomacy on Zimbabwe, it's not a South African policy. It's nowhere in any of the South African policy. It was coined in the public domain. And South Africa had to come, the communicators of South African foreign policy had to step in only to deny it. No, it's not our policy. I sense you can't blame people for ascribing certain policies to South Africa when they don't actually understand what it is that we're trying to do. The issue of Myanmar, for example, I think we could have been more proactive and explain what it is that we are trying to do, rather than respond to a certain kind of characterization of our policy on Myanmar. We can name a number of areas, but generally our articulation of policy is very poor. In many ways, it undermines very good and very strong and very principled policy. The fact that we are not articulating them well enough. It's very common to Mabuchole to go to foreign affairs and go to the desk on Cote d'Ivoire, and then you ask them, what is it that we're trying to do in Cote d'Ivoire? How do we relate our mediation with our diplomatic services and so on? And then they cannot tell you. They don't get a sense of that. So it's not only just the public, but the department itself, I think, has to work very carefully to make sure that its policy position, especially in very critical areas that can be that can attract a lot of criticism, that is very clear about what it is that we want to do. Our engagement with the citizens on our foreign policy, key foreign policy activities, is very what's the word? The very thing that we're doing. Apart from the visas that we had in Cape Town last year, the DFA visas, I haven't seen any visas by DFA. But I think there's an assumption that people understand that our foreign policy is an extension of domestic policy. But I think because it's such a tricky area, it's not always obvious. So people think that we are investing too much in Africa. Some people think that we are traveling too much. Some people think that we are robbing South Africa of resources that should be invested in service delivery and investing it in all of them. Because we have not explained to them that by investing in the peace in the DRC, we are actually assisting Limpopo to grow in a very specific way. Because then we are preventing in the long run the immigration of economic immigrants and political immigrants from DRC and all of that. But they don't quite see that link between what we are doing, investing, the energies we are investing in the continent, have what bearing they those things have on their own situations within the country. I think the general issue of capacity within foreign affairs, and I'm sure if you look at the strategic plan itself, it will show you that the a lot more vacancies than should be accepted. There's huge vacancies. And I remember that, you know, we've been tracking this. I remember in 2001 when that issue was raised again. And here we are, what is it, 6 years down the line, we still have not been able to do that. And in some of the areas, these are critical areas, DDGs, chief directors, and all of that. I'm not saying where we should rush into it and risk putting people in place that do not have sufficient ability to provide strategic management to our foreign policy, but I still think that we have to show what it is that we are doing to do that, including how we want to manage this aggressive expansion in terms of diplomatic missions with the need to consolidate what we already have. Because in 2007, 2008, we are planning some aggressive expansion as well, which is good. We need to be everywhere. But how do you balance that with the need for manpower within the state? What's the point of establishing all those missions and then you do not have depth to service them? And then you do not have managers in particular area to provide leadership to them. And I think we need also to work very clearly and very deliberately in building our economic diplomacy, our ability to handle the issues of trade and economy in the world and in Africa. Does need some sharpening. It's a challenge all over the world. This economic diplomacy thing is a challenge all over the world. You have to get a clear sense that the Foreign Service Institute or any other mechanisms that we have are actually making sure that we increase that. And there are opportunities around greater collaboration between DSA and DTI to compensate for weaknesses where we have weaknesses. And I do not see why we should not use experts that are out there to provide technical support, at least resource support, as resource person to assist us. I often see that the British use the London School of Economics every time they go to WTO. There are five professors behind to just flesh out some of the more technical issues and the diplomats in front to do the actual diplomatic work. And I haven't seen us do that. So we find that in many occasions we are outnumbered. But it's a general African problem. It's ability to make use of the experts that we have created. It's not an invitation. It's not a request to invite me. But I think it's a request to identify people like Chris Landsberg, who've been on the field for quite some time and then get a variety of views. Even at least to workshop and brainstorm the positions that we are putting across. But in some areas, we can see that if there was some form of brainstorming and sounding, these ideas of with experts would have done better. I think I must just leave it there. But I think there are serious challenges that we need to look at, including the issue of balancing and managing the negative effects of corporate expansion that is following our political inroads into the continent, because it does bring with it the old cost of apartheid. And I haven't seen a clear strategy to say, how do we make sure that this corporate expansion, checkers, and gold and everybody else, does not undermine the good things that we're trying to do on the continent. Thank you for allowing me to have this my time.
Thank you. I think what we're going to do, it's 12:30 now. We are going to take it up until 1:00. And then we'll break for lunch then. And then have discussions with COSATU after lunch. That's one alternative. The other is to take COSATU presentation and then we deal with questions once in totality. And Dr. Chris, I know that there's a flight at 2:10. So So I thought that they will be able to delay him until we take him, to get him to answer questions before he leaves. Maybe I should open up for questions now. Vamos, Pastor.
No, Mr. Chairman, I was going to say that he personally requested that you shorten the time by 30 minutes. It's not here now. You can go back to 3 o'clock and instead of 2:30. So we can handle the question from now, 1:30 to, 12, 1:30. And then do our 30 minutes lunch and then come back and still proceed. Can I just make some comments? Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm sure we all agree that the presentations are really thought-provoking. And Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you can see that given these two presentations, we need two to three days of a workshop to engage some of these issues in detail if we're going to do justice to them and come out with a comprehensive program. But let me start with this this question of the peace diplomacy, which both Chris and Dr. Zondi touched on. And without breaching a protocol, I must say that recently I had a brief communication with the President and the Minister and the Deputy Minister on this issue of the peace diplomacy. But I was referring particularly to the questions of Palestine, where I was saying that it would be a good thing to establish what I then termed a multi-party presidential peace envoy. Because I noticed that in this parliament, when you talk about the Middle East, you talk about Zimbabwe, we are all at variance. We are not at one with those countries or how to handle the issues in there. I'm not going to go into what the president said, but without breaching any protocol. The issue of NEPAD and the AU, yes, I agree that perhaps the AU ought to also handle the question of the African agenda to assist South Africa. But it also comes to the issue of resources. Now, NEPAD, Dr. Zondi said, and Chris also, that there are some challenges facing NEPAD. I think some of the challenges really are not homegrown, but if you look at the Blair Commission for Africa, on the face value, you're going to find that the objectives are the same with NEPAD. But I'm not quite sure when it comes to implementation and provision of resources and finances, really we do get anything from that quarter. That is the Blair Commission. The other issue I wanted to deal with is this, the reform of the Bretton Woods institutions. I'm not sure whether we will be effective in doing that, because when I look at our economic advisors in South Africa, I found that to the London School of Economics, Harvard, and so on, I haven't seen an African economist in there. And some of the principles that we use, because of our advisors and their origin, is really with the Washington consensus. So it's going to be very difficult for us to really transform the IMF, the World Bank, if we are still using some of the advisors who originate from those institutions and the other related at once. And now you mentioned the Zimbabwe slightly. I did say we are at variance here about those issues. Because I believe now Zimbabwe is gradually becoming a failing state. And failing states have a tendency of wanting to go and decay in isolation. And that should not be allowed to happen. Because if it happens, then it would then graduate to a rogue state, and rogue states would also use Zimbabwe as a rallying point. Even terrorism will do the same thing. And it will also be a problem with investments in the region. But then I question the our approach to it, because I think Sadak is not fair to us, and they are not fair to President Mbeki. They say, fine, let South Africa deal with Zimbabwe. I think that is opting out. Because you want to have a joint strategy of dealing with Zimbabwe, not a South African one. Which means then South Africa is going to struggle to deal with Zimbabwe at all. So I don't know what we're going to do with that one. Now, Dr. Zondi also spoke about these lofty ideas, supreme internationalists and so on. I think, yes, but we also have our domestic pursuits. I agree that with the lofty ideas, internationalism, we want to pursue those. But I think we're also governed by our own domestic pursuits, which are international interests. Where I want Chris also to or Dr. Zondi to distinguish this. These domestic problems and which or pursuits which are could be breaking us down, and the concept of national interest, because I think this ought to be very clear to us what do we mean by those things. Now let me just stop there.
Thank you, Chairperson, I will start maybe to comment about the both inputs, that they are very formative. But unfortunately, we don't have papers for them because they need a thorough interrogation. Then come to a question. You see, Chairperson, maybe I'd like from the first input to clarify on this one, because you indicated about African agenda, while it seems it mentioned that there are two approaches, one of the continental Africanism and the Pan-Africanism, which is led by Mbeki, President Mbeki, and then also there's another one of this Pan-Africanism, which is led by Mama Gaddafi. So, the clarity is that I wanted maybe if you can assist us, to check or to evaluate that which one are other people, the majority of the people in Africa are following, because it might happen that some of the people, they don't have interest with the other one, they do have interest with the other one. At the same time, from the both input, I'll link them both. My worry is that with the second input by Umar Zondi, about the issue, the intervention by South Africa in Côte d'Ivoire and ECOWAS, I'm a little bit concerned because it is alleged that some of these countries within Africa, they are still being used as instrumental of imperialism, whereby some of the countries are just following their fellow colonizers. Maybe if you can clarify us that what is, so that we can maybe be able to check exactly that where is the problem. Because the way they put this thing, South Africans started to pave the way. And then when it was nearly to be corrected, then Nigeria seems to take it back and give it to other people to correct it. Why is it happening like that? Because I think we were on the correct way. And then also, we were facing a challenge, a very serious challenge, whereby this thing of trading, globally trading. I wanted maybe to check that, where are we on the right path or not? Because I'll put an example whereby these China's things which are here at the moment, while at the same time we are facing the political situation within Africa. So that maybe we can be able to know exactly that where are we on the correct track or in the wrong track as we're facing these political challenges within the African continent. because I think it's very difficult maybe to have, I mean, while we're having such, I mean, a political challenge at the same time, we're being faced by another dilemma, which is going to be a beast next time. And then also, last one, by the first input, that I'm not clear, I don't know where to put it, but it seems that some people at the time, South Africa is going to face a challenge whereby people, they will, I mean, I don't know whether they trust it or they trust South Africa or not in their interventions, but it seems there was a report or something like that, that we are going to face the challenge as the time goes on with our own interventions. I'll put it there.
No, thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to... thank you, Chairperson, thank you to the two presenters. I think quite a number of things raised in this. I think Honorable Kosan is right. I think we need another workshop to go through to all these things. In fact, I always enjoy your presentation, Chris. I was saying when you came here, I think we can just as well as adopt you as a permanent presenter here, because ever since I came in, all the presentations were here. You see, the questions you raised are really a concern. Now I want to ask you, how do you see us as a portfolio committee intervening in some of these things? For instance, you raised the question of NEPAD secretariat, you know, just disappearing and not doing as expected. And you spoke about the vacancies. You spoke about our former diplomats coming back and assisting us and training other people and talking to us. Now to me, with the portfolio committee, where do you see us intervening in oversight? Because I think now these things that are raised here, and this thing of the officials, because you are quite correct that some of the duties are left with the officials, the politicians leave them to the officials. And that's a very common thing. In all spheres of government, you'll find that the officials take over certain duties and they never do them to the satisfaction of the whole nation. So how do you see us actually intervening in this? How do we go about to correct this, you know, as a portfolio committee?
Yeah, thank you very much for what has really been very illuminating that has been put before us as the Portfolio Committee of Foreign Affairs this morning. I think that perhaps I'm in the same hole as my comrade Macho over there. Personally, I've been very concerned that there seems to be a disconnect between our resources as foreign affairs and the ambitious commitments, you know, that we have in both, you know, continentally and in fact beyond the African continent. And these resources, really human as well as, you know, in financial terms, there's a real disproportion, and it continues to widen For instance, if you talk about the main 40 binational, you know, and all those kind of binational commissions and all that kind of things, it seems that the planning in terms of what we can effectively do and what we, you know, what we, the vision and what we really, there's a runaway there, and we cannot really keep up with it. Now, it goes on, you know, I mean, for instance, a good example of that is the AU, you know, the AU. We want to have a peacekeeping force, you know, we want to do things our way as Africa and Africans and all that kind of thing. If people are getting help coming from anybody else, it must fit itself into our own, you know, program. Now, the world does not want to do that. If they are going to put health there, they also want to serve their own, their interests well, you know, and all that kind of thing. We've seen the AU peacekeeping force struggling, you know, out there in Africa, really to the point where it's almost embarrassing, because we're wanting to do, we know what we want to do, but we simply cannot do it. Now, this is a point, as far as I'm concerned, it's a point of major concern, that how do we deal with this kind of thing, where our program and our ambition seems to run away from what we can effectively do in terms of human and financial resources. Now, I would like you perhaps to, you know, to give us you know, an idea of how this issue can be, you know, can be raised by us effectively. That's why I say she's probably the same role as us, effectively with the department, and how we can get some something to happen in that regard. It's really at the bottom of everything that we want to do. Thank you.
What I'm going to do is that I'm going to allow, because Chris must leave at one, that probably you pick up the questions that you may answer and ask Dr. Zodi, because I think he'll be with us after lunch, that he can pick up the remainder of the issues, and possibly then he can be able to raise other issues, because I think there's a question of regional economic issues that I may want to raise, because it's a huge area as to how they overlap over each other.
Sure.
You've raised that particular issue. Thanks for this correction. Let me
first react to some of the things Dr. Zondi said, because I think some very important issues came out. Let me throw a challenge to the Department of Foreign Affairs. I think the Foreign Service Institute represents for me a bit of a dichotomy. There's absolutely no doubt that over the last couple of years, they've really moved on and made some very serious inroads. I am delighted to see how seriously they are taken at very top level in the ministry, by the ministry itself. But I still feel, however, that the FSI has such a strategic role to play, but it's underutilized for a host of reasons. And my starting point in addressing the human resource challenge of foreign affairs will be there. By the way, I just want to echo something Dr. Zondi said. How many departments of government do we have? I'm not really sure if it's 26 or 25, 27, 25, whatever it is. Foreign affairs is the most underrepresented in terms of vacancies. No other department in South Africa, in the South African government, has so many vacancies as the Department of Foreign Affairs. I think it's a serious issue that we have to address. Second point I want to echo that Dr. Zondi said. I think it is inexcusable that we spend so much money on paying our international dues to every single multilateral institution we are a member of, But we are the most underrepresented country in the world in all our multilateral institutions. I can tell you, that poses a national interest crisis. You can't be so much in the forefront of investing in these things, and yet you don't have people there to defend your own national interest in these institutions. But I think the problem is broader than government, and this is the challenge I want to throw to the Department of Foreign Affairs. And Dr. Skusana, you touched on, I mean, you used a very curious phrase that I have to agree with when you said that, you know, there's not common meeting of eye on many of these things between government and various constituencies, and you used examples of Zimbabwe. There's a broader problem in this society that affects not only the Department of Foreign Affairs. I am concerned, quite frankly, about the love-hate relationship between government on the one hand and NGOs on the other. Government on the one hand, opposition political parties on the other. Listen to this one. Government on the one hand, universities on the other. I know of not a single university in this country who currently teaches a program on diplomacy. They teach many international relations courses, many. But there's not a single one of them that I know who's teaching a program geared towards training students for public service in diplomacy. So I just think that given our history where we come from, this country can't afford that luxury. So here's what I want to throw as a challenge. The relationship between DFA and academic institutions, DFA and NGOs, and FSI in these institutions must be sorted out. Where I would have a slight disagreement with Dr. Zondi, I think these institutions are just as ambivalent about relating to government and the FSI as government is about relating to them. I think it's a mutual suspicion that must be addressed. This committee can play a fundamental role in addressing that problem. Target departments of international relations and politics who train and who teaches foreign policy and international relations, and call gatherings like this. In the spirit of dialogue, what is your curriculum? It's not to interrogate them necessarily, but just to encourage them to become better at serving the national interest. I'm very, very worried about that. The second one, and here I want to react to Ben Skusana. By the way, Dr. Zondi, I don't think it's a bad thing that in our foreign policy, Ben, we place less of an emphasis on NEPAD than we used to. I actually think that NEPAD started to undermine our role and credibility in Africa. There was a growing view not so long ago that we overplay NEPAD even at the expense of the AU. Our current policy seems to be that we agree with the idea that NEPA should belong to the AU and should go there. We might do it for reluctant reasons. We're giving, handing NEPA over. My worry is, are we going to have South Africans there to be part of the process of managing the integration of NEPA into the AU? So for me, I think politically it was a smart move. But can we ensure that it becomes more relevant as opposed to dying a slow death in the African Union? So, I'll just make that point. Your point about South African diplomacy and your fascinating concept of a multi-party peace envoy concept, I think it's fascinating. But you know what, Dr. Skusana, there must be growing up on both sides. Government must become less sensitive about who he brings in and works with. But those outside government and those outside ANC-dominated government must also grow up and realize there are certain things in this country we can agree on across divides, political divides, government NGO divides, that they are simply in the national interest and we can agree on them. That we need peace envoys. And peace envoys can come from the DA, they can come from the IFP, they can come from ID, etc., etc., etc. But I really think we should do that. Patrick, fascinating question. First of all, let me just stress again that those in favor of continentalism are in the majority. Those who support our president's view of building institutions, consolidating institutions, strengthening institutions, are in the majority. Right? So that's the good news. The bad news is, in that majority group, and I think there are many of 70% of African heads of state and governments who support the consolidation route as opposed to rushing into the United States of Africa. 70%. My worry is that within that 70%, there are those who support our president's view, but for terrible ulterior motives. They don't want the status quo to change. They don't want Africa to move towards effective governance, human rights, accountability. So that's why they support it. But they don't wholeheartedly supporting the strengthening of it. And you know where you can test them? Test them on whether they are willing to pay their dues to the African Union, sub-regional bodies, and meet their commitment. There is a crisis of funding with the African Union and all its institutions. For us to approve a budget of $12 million for the Pan-African Parliament is quite frankly a joke. It's not serious. You cannot approve a budget for the entire African Union of $50 million. Come on. We're just not serious. So, while President Mbeki can be comforted that President Gaddafi will be beaten again diplomatically, among that group are those for ulterior motives. How did the portfolio committee help? I think we are in a fascinating moment in the history of this parliament and therefore for the committee. I think parliament has moved on, and the question of accountability and oversight is on the agenda. But here's the interesting thing. For me, the easy way to do it, and the most effective way to do it, is you don't even have to have huge fights with the executives about it. Simply hold the executives to their own goals that they have set for themselves. Measure them on it constantly. And by the way, I think we've reached a point, especially given that the current head of state has two and a half years to go. I actually think we need to consolidate our own agenda. I think the agenda is becoming too big, by the way. I think we're adding to this foreign policy agenda too much. There's clarity, there's predictability. Let's consolidate what we have as opposed to overburdening an already agenda. And the role of this parliament is exactly to do those kinds of things, is that you're taking on far too much without the necessary resources. The role of this committee is to really ensure that our colleagues there do not have a situation where we have 500 out of over 2,000 officials that is not full, posts that are not full. It's too big. It's just to use a gift. What are we doing? And let's measure them on things like that. But the biggest hope that I have is that a committee like this will get directly involved in interrogating the role of institutions like the Foreign Service Institute. That's the one institute I have a lot of hope for the future, but it is underperforming. So it's underperforming because of the people there. We simply don't appreciate how strategically that thing is located. I want to give you one example. There is no reason why the Foreign Service Institute itself cannot identify one or two or three universities of their choice and approach them as opposed to waiting for those universities to come to the institute and say to them, we want an advanced diploma course. We want an advanced degree course. We have the students in terms of the officials we have. We guarantee you we'll have 20 students signing up in the first year, and another 20 the second, another 20 the third, whatever it is. We won't even pay for them to go and study. I can assure you those universities will jump at the opportunity. But we don't do things like that. And it'll become more attractive for people to get diplomatic training if they know it comes with the guarantee of recognition in the form of a qualification at the end of the day. So, secondly, this parliament, I know for a fact, has so many resources from donors for training and so on. This committee should simply elevate foreign affairs and say, we now want to talk to experts out there, institutions out there, to create courses for us, and especially those courses can be credited, and so we just don't do these things. So, I conclude with this thought. I have limited experience with the Foreign Service Institute. My biggest worry with the Foreign Service Institute is that the training we provide at the Foreign Service Institute does not match the ambitious foreign policy agenda that our country is embarking on. So, we don't do enough training on peace diplomacy, on trade and economic diplomacy, on public diplomacy, on the country's foreign policy ambitions. And we must get out of this routine where we have a set program for those who go to the Foreign Service Institute simply because, you know, they have to show that they do some protocol programs here and there. That place I have the greatest hope for to become even more strategic than it does. And this committee can really, must start to elevate. I mean, what the two of us have done this morning speaks to the problem. We come here and we present for you essentially the political challenges of our foreign policy, how we relate to the outside world, America, Europe, South, and so on. We too must become better at closing the gap between the political, strategic foreign policy agenda and the administrative, human resource, financial resource challenges, and become better at closing that gap ourselves and help the Foreign Service Institute and the Department about this thing. But I think our foreign policy has become too big for us. It's become too big for our country. And I'm worried about whether we can execute this ambitious foreign policy. You can do it in only one of two ways. Consolidate now, but let's build the capacity from junior level right up at even ambassadorial level and build their skills in diplomacy that I don't think we have. And incidentally, I should tell you, university professors are the worst in what kind of products we send to the Department of Foreign Affairs. These kids come there, they have no clue about the real world. We train them in esoteric theoretical understandings of the globe is very important. But there's no culture that has developed in post-94 South Africa about training people for the public service, including foreign affairs. I'm worried there's no institutional basis training for people on how you go and manage the public service. We don't send out those graduates to the Department of Foreign Affairs and the public service in general. There are a couple of exceptions like PMDM at Wits, for example, that I think are trying hard. Stellenbosch School, but that's for local government and so on. Foreign affairs lags behind in equipping people for practical foreign service. We don't have that culture here. And the Foreign Service Institute is my hope. Thank you. Then I must really run so that I can't be attacked anymore. By the way, Pat, I'm more than willing to leave my paper so that you can interrogate it. And if you send me nasty comments, I'll ignore them. If you send me nice comments, I'll respond.
Honourable members, I think I'm starting to talk about
just for the record, I know Chris, when he spoke, he said Dr. Kotana. I just want to put it straight, he just missed it. Ben, you know that.
Ben, I'm glad you mentioned it, but now that I've made the mistake, please come and sign up for a PhD at the university.
Honourable members, I think what we need to do is to break for lunch. I think Dr. Zondo will then pick up some of the issues when we come back. It's a pity that Chris will have left, but will have gone back to discuss the FSI. And I think Mamposolo is there. You would know what has been happening with that institute in this committee. We've touched the nerve that we've for years trying to get that institute moving. I'm glad that you say that there's something happening. I don't have a sense of it. If you ask my honest opinion, I know that DG raised the level of the institute to a chief director at DDG. At DDG, I still said we are not doing what we need to be doing. I've maintained this. That institute in the first instance is wrongly located. It should not fight for its resources from other sub-directorates of the department. If you want an institute, run it as an institute. Don't run it as one of the entities within the department. We should expropriate budget for it in this committee, give it unnecessary resources, run it as a fully fledged institute that must produce the diplomats that you want. But so long as you run it as a sub-directorate somewhere, of course the DG will have an overall responsibility, but give its own resources. Let it run as an institute. But so long as you run it as one of the things and it has to go and fight for tissue paper with everybody else, you're not going to run that institute. My view is that we still do not do what we need to do. Put a DDG there, run it as an independent institute, of course, report to the DG, so that then it can do what we expect it to do. But it's a pre-primary institute. We appoint Chris as a diplomat, he goes there for 2 weeks, and then he comes back. My view is that once you structure that institute correctly, you will then be able to take in students. That will then be able to academically assign them to do thorough research work. In that way, improve your policy formulation. Because it means that student, when he comes out of that institute, is equipped, but the knowledge that is able, out of the research that they've been doing, to be able to pass it to the department for policy consideration will be enormous. And that research is secret. The student is dedicated there, he comes up with those research work, it's free, we don't have to go and pay for it. It's our student, it's our employee, he comes up with that knowledge, you will then be able to have South Africa's policy dynamic, able to answer in advanced questions, but able at the same time to deal with the challenges at that point in time. That's how I view the institute. But so long as we run it as some entity there, and I always say that they have to go and fight for a feedback with all other interests in the department, it's not going to work. Let's go for lunch, members, and come back at 30 minutes from now. Thank you.
eradication, issues of what should be a common resource management approach, mechanism, and so on. How do you deal with this question of resource dependency, and how do you deal with issues of debt? How do you deal with issues of narrow economic base? How do you deal with the issues of the fact that Africa provides only primary commodities to the world, to the world trade, and all of that? But I think that the challenge was, Chairman, the fact that, and maybe I should just, before I get to the challenge, I'll say, the continent went on to make bold policy statements around that, even though they were not central to the agenda of AU. You will remember the Cairo process, that led to Cairo Plan in 1980. That was followed by the Abuja Treaty that established what was called the Economic Community of Africa in 1991, and that directly led to the establishment of a number of regional economic communities such as ECOWAS, ECAS, SEMA in Central Africa, the older East African community, and in many ways the frontline state institution that evolved into the Southern African Development Cooperation Community, SADCC, with the predecessor to SADC. So that momentum to establish this regional economic community came out of a discussion within the AU itself, but still on the periphery of it. One example is that instead of making this question of economic integration a central element of the AU agenda itself, they established almost like a parallel institution which was called the Economic Community of Africa through the Abuja Treaty. And there was almost a resistance to muddy the established agenda before colonization is complete, before Namibia independence has been achieved, before South Africa's freedom has been achieved as well. So there was that. In many ways, that played itself out even in the period after South Africa's freedom. With the establishment of NEPAD outside the AU, and it remains outside the AU, now the big challenge is how you integrate it into the AU. It should have been an AU program in the first place, rather than exist somewhere brought in. This dichotomy between the political and economic is a big challenge. I think that out of what you're saying, there is a strong recognition of the importance of regional integration. But I think there was a sense in many parts of the continent that you could let this regional integration almost run its course in whichever direction it wants to go. So, for example, you find that SADC begins where it is, generally Southern Africa, but then you allow it to go north towards Central Africa. So you have countries that are entering Central Africa that are part of SADC. Angola, in many ways, is Central Africa, and DRC is Central Africa, right in the center of Africa. And then you have, last year, an application by Burundi and Rwanda to join SADC. And they're right in the Great Lakes. And then we have Tanzania as a member of SADC, right in East Africa. The position that was taken at some point, or an understanding that they developed at some point, that you should allow those who are willing to form part of a particular regional economic community to be part of it, even if geographically it doesn't make sense. That is why when the SADC leaders were asked, actually it was Secretary Masire of Botswana when he was the chair of SADC about 4 or 5 years ago, when he was asked, where do you draw a line? He said, you know, you don't draw a geographical line. You only draw an agenda line. So then everybody said, oh, so it means Central African Republic, Chad, Sudan, can become part of SADC if they identify with the SADC agenda. I said, no, that's the attitude we have. Those who are committed to SADC, they can become part of SADC. But that attitude, it was okay was seen to be okay at that particular time in order to entrench the idea of regional cooperation. That if if we want this idea of cooperation to happen, allow some element of flexibility. For SADC, especially because there was no functional regional economic community for Central Africa. There are countries that have an impact on Southern Africa, and countries whose membership have a potential impact on Southern Africa, such as DRC, the Inga Dam, has the capacity to supply the whole of Southern Africa, 14 states, with hydroelectricity over a period of 6 years. It has the capacity to boost the regional GDP because of its rich mineral resources over a long and unforeseeable future. It has the capacity to add, you know, a lot of human capacity as well because of the size of its population. It has the capacity, therefore, to shift the balance in terms of regional economic power balances in favor of Southern Africa because of its sheer size. But also, it has the capacity to add a particular dimension to SADC that it didn't have. It was mainly Anglophone and Lusophone. You know, Portuguese speaking and English speaking. It was going to add a Francophone country. That was going to be very critical in terms of continental debate. That's how they reasoned. Because otherwise, if you do not have that, then the West Africa is able to outbox you on the basis of the fact that they are much more balanced. They have all three. I think that's part of the logic. But then, recently, I'm sure you know about the AU decision to rationalize the regional economic community. And let me just say that even on the point of expansion of SADC and how far it goes, I don't know what Sarabka's position was. I don't know. I just assume that we went along the general understanding that we should allow it to evolve. My own sense was that as South Africa, we were concentrated quite strongly on SACU. For right reasons, because SACU is a huge market for our goods. It's a huge market for our businesses. It is of our own self-economic interest to have SACU. It's our domain, and it's a domain that we didn't want to give to anyone else. But then it became a challenge when we have now to be part of a broader regional economic agenda, where we have to try and balance our interest in SACU and our interest in SADC. As I said earlier on, we still have not made up our mind. At least I do not know what we have decided in regards to when the crunch time comes, when SADC has to establish its customs union in 2010, about 2 years from now. South Africa will have to choose whether it is part of SACU because it's a customs union, or it becomes part of a SADC customs union. You can't be a member of two customs unions at the same time. It's going to be a serious challenge. So this rationalization process as well is going to force South Africa to take a decision one way or the other. Because what this rationalization is saying that the AU has decided that it wants five regions, and this regional economic communities must fall into four and five geographical regions. Southern Africa, East Africa, Central Africa, North Africa, and West Africa. It's going to force a number of countries that are part of SADC, that are also part of COMESA, to make a choice whether they want to be part of COMESA or part of SADC. And there are a number of countries that are members of four different countries, different regions. Countries like countries in Central Africa that are part of CEMAC, ECAS, ECOWAS, and COMESA at the same time, countries like Cameroon. So they're going to have to make a choice as to which region they support. Because it was okay to be very relaxed and flexible about this configuration of region at a time when we had to establish the basis for it. But now that we want to move to the next level, not just consolidate, but to make them active in advancing a particular agenda, make them active in protecting regions and countries from unfair global trade practices. When we want them to be useful platforms for common agendas, when we discuss the economic partnership agreements, when we discuss, you know, other economic partnerships, when we discuss under AGOA, we need to consolidate a little bit more and be very clear which regional economic committees are functional and which ones should be dissolved. And I think that is what is going to resolve the problem. But ironically, that is part of the problem. The fact that a number of states benefit from being members of three or four regions, and I think that's the part of the reason why this process is taking a long time. There's a lot of resistance to this pressure to make a choice. For a country like Tanzania, it benefits from through its membership to SADC, it benefits in terms of access to huge southern, lucrative southern African markets in terms of trade. And Tanzania has made a lot of benefit from membership to SADC. But it also benefits from this free trade area under COMESA, which gives it access to economic opportunities from Southern Africa right up to Central Africa, a very unique area, up to the whole of Africa, all the way, they want it. But also, in their own region, they are a key member of East African community, and they see it as their a spring point, as their basis for launching its their own global agenda, because they've developed a global agenda, especially under the current President Jakaya Kikwete. So, countries like that will find it very difficult to make a choice one way or the other. That's the thing. But another question, you can discuss this much more broadly. But I think there are challenges as well around, for example, North Africa. The Arab Maghreb Union is non-functional, has not functioned for the past 15 years, partly over because of tensions over Western Sahara. So North Africa effectively does not have a regional economic community. Instead, what you tend to find is that the North African countries tend to use their membership of Arab League as a platform for cooperation, and which is problematic, because Arab League is not part of an African agenda. It's got a different agenda altogether. And also, the economic opportunities that exist in that particular region are being missed because of lack of cooperation among these countries. Instead, there's a greater push in that particular region for a union with Europe. There's this idea of Mediterranean Union, which would bring together countries in Southern Europe with countries in North Africa. We will have a serious challenge there, because it simply means that the EU decision may not be implemented in that particular region, because they have calculated and thought that for them, integration with Europe will provide stronger incentives than integrating with Africa. On other issues, I agree with you. I agree with honourable member over the question that NEPAD, and if you look at NEPAD and the UK Commission of Africa, you may think that they have the same things, they are about the same issues, but they are quite different. I think one very clear thing is that when the OAU at the time adopted the Economic Commission of Africa, the Economic Community of Africa Agreement, the Abuja Treaty, the very same year, the World Bank, later I call it that year, developed what was called the African Agenda. Can Africa claim the 21st century? There's a huge report. Again, we see the same trend here. The Africans developed some form of what would be their agenda in terms of economic and development issues. And you'll always find that the countries in the north, some powerful forces, will have the similar thing to take the initiative away from what has already been established. I think that was the challenge with the Blair Commission. But fortunately, the Blair Commission fills this out. But also one challenge that it has is that it committed the same mistake that it said, that the European Union said Africa was committing. Because Africa adopted a position which was to say, when you are establishing the NEPAD, everybody will be a member of it. You don't have a form of qualification. Then the crazy ones, then you have the Democrats and the non-democratic dictators and the democracy together. That was the criticism. But if you look at the Blair Commission, they did the same. You have Ethiopia there, given a critical role in that commission and a number of countries that have dubious agenda. I think a member who asked about this question of who are we using as advisors and whether we are using some of our own critical intellectual capacity to do that. I agree with you. We rely quite heavily on the Harvard School of Governance. This Harvard School of Governance is behind policy thinking in Washington. They influence Washington for policy thinking. Which means they are powerful. They can make a lot of difference. And we tend to rely on them. And I don't think maybe that necessarily is a problem if you know exactly what your agenda is. But I think it does present problem when you are only receiving advice from one kind of school of thought. There's a number of schools of thought in the world. There are Asians, there are Indians, there are European, African, schools of thought that you can benefit from. And on the question of balancing lofty ideas and national interests, I agree with you, because often you find that you aren't able to work out what is it that is our national interest in this thing, except the lofty supreme value, moral values and so on. And on Cote d'Ivoire, I think we, like I said, I'm not going to repeat myself, but what our sense was that I think it's either South Africa were naive. We thought that all these members of ECOWAS, all these critical states that are playing a huge role in Cote d'Ivoire, support what we are trying to do. But we went there with a very honest approach. Our approach was to be very fair, very even-handed, get them all on board, get a sense of what is their problem, deal with those problems. In other words, remove the obstacles to implementation of an agreement they had signed earlier. But what we didn't understand is that it was not as simple as that. That actually, maybe it's true, this adage that is so commonly quoted, which says, in international politics, they are not friends, they are interests. What we have are interests. To understand what the interests of these various powers, not that you need to isolate them, not that you need to keep them away, but know how to leverage them in advancing what you want to do. I think on China, it's a big challenge. Generally, the view that I share with a number of people is that you do not turn away from China. You do not act as if they are not there. You do not wish they were not there. But you try and find opportunities to use their global strength to leverage your own interests in the world. I think, like I said about the U.S., we just have to find a way of dancing with a giant and use the giant's power as much as you can to advance your interests. Because the Chinese they are very clear about what they want from Africa. They are really very clear about what they actually want. Whether they, as a continent, we understand and we know and we agree on what we actually want is a different question. And I'm not seeing any country taking leadership in terms of saying this should be essential ingredient of an African position with regards to how it deals with China. Well, China presents all sorts of serious difficulties, serious challenges, but it also presents huge opportunities in terms of our economy, in terms of our global position, and we can use it and then don't respect and all of that. Let me just take it up to that. In terms of what the portfolio committee probably should do, I agree with Chris Landsberg. I think for me the big challenge is what sort of questions does the portfolio committee ask when it meets not just the political authorities of the department, but more especially the officials, because my own sense is that a lot of power actually rests with the officials. A lot of influence, a lot of opportunities arise when you know that your officials understand what this parliament expects of the department to do. Asking serious questions around specific areas, around SSI, for example, around SACU, SADC, what are we deciding? Around NEPA, what is now our position on NEPA? Are we really letting it go? Around issues of peace diplomacy, around creating the peace diplomacy capacity, around this huge vacancies, large number of vacancies within the department, around managerial capacity, a number of other things. And I think you also have an opportunity to propose certain things that they need to mull over and then to hold them to account for whatever commitments they make to this parliament. And I think in order to do that, the portfolio committee itself would have to be very up to date with the issues, would have to brainstorm on these issues a bit more. We have to be quite energetic. We have to keep the department on its toes as a form of a culture and on a sustained way. And we also have to identify, for instance, what are the key priorities that it wants actually be able to zero in and nudge the department around. I think that would be, even if in itself it's not agreed about how things should move, but it should be able to identify these are critical things that we need to challenge the department on. I think for me, I would say, is to say, how do we give this foreign policy a sense of gravity? How do we say this foreign policy, how do we cause it to address national interest as well? How does it balance these lofty or the supreme values of creating peace on the continent, of making an impact in the world, of creating global partnerships and all of that, with how that assists South Africa deliver on its own national agenda. It's a difficult balancing act. Other countries have got it, others haven't got it, but it's quite a fundamental problem.
Thank you, Doctor. Now you get all of us trying to think how we need to do that. I'm aware that there are a number of issues that you've raised in your presentation in Nigeria. You've repeated it in terms of its interest in our intervention in Côte d'Ivoire. Maybe what you're raising is for us to look at the South Africa-Nigeria relations at some point at the committee. To look at that, what is this relationship, what informs this relationship. And at some point look at the South Africa-US and South Africa-France. Because they play a particular role and they play a particular influence. And to look at and China, South Africa-China. It is argued by a number of people picking up on this China thing that, in fact, if you look at China's response on a number of times and a number of issues in the international arena, if the issue does not affect China's interest, they are less conservative. It is argued that China only speaks when an issue affects them or affects their interests. Now, that raises a very interesting question. That China hasn't come out of being a developing country on one hand, and that does not have a history of colonization, to what extent is it willing to carry the developing world with it as it interacts with the international agenda? Because it means that when there are positions that compromise developing countries, so long as they are not affected, they will not get involved in that. Whilst in fact, the whole community of developing countries are compromised in that. Is China-Africa relations? Is Africa only the provider of primary resources for China? Or is China looking at a relationship with Africa that will actually seek to develop even the manufacturing capacity of the Africa and the processing of those primary products into supplying intermediate goods to China, unlike only extracting the resources? Because if it does that, then the question is, what difference is it to those who colonized the continent? Because that's precisely what they did. Gold is mined in South Africa, but processed somewhere else.
and therefore it needs to look for a different relationship. Mr. Masugo, we are in your hands. If you could come forward so that we can then have some time for engagement in some of these questions, because I think it will be quite interesting to see how different constituencies of society relate with our rules. What will be interesting also at some point for us to look at even social movements. Chris raised the fact that we should look at universities as to how they respond to international relations, and what is it that they could provide for international relations. So we thought that it was important for us to understand the COSATU's engagement in that particular area and demystify international relations as the preserve of Dr. Zondi Omni. That in fact the labor does get involved also, they become interested in how these relations are conducted. Because some of these agreements have impact on labor. I'm raising this because I remember that when we kicked out of Zimbabwe, our Minister of Labor said that, but we've got agreement in Zimbabwe. COSATU should have followed certain procedures that we agreed on and all that. So it means that in those engagements, there are issues that have a direct impact on how you conduct solidarity work and how you conduct relations with other federations. Yes,
no, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members of the House. I think first and foremost, I want to take the opportunity to say, to appreciate the moment to at least share our views on matters that we regard as of critical concern to the country, to the people, and to all of us. I do not want to go back to what comrades or to what colleagues Chris and Samantha have related to with regard to the specifics of the global dynamics. But I think our concern is to raise those areas that we think are of particular concern to non-state actors, because that is where we are principally. But first and foremost, I think the most important thing is that in the context of a dynamic global context or global situation and very complex challenges, how do you keep your eyes on the ball? Because I think we may all agree that there is so much that needs to be done. But how do you relate your capacity, which must determine what you can do, and relate to the priorities, absolute priorities that you face? Because I think I agree with the two previous speakers' emphasis that the agenda keeps piling. But does it assist us to get to the core of what at this moment is the critical task that we face? I know that in most instances when a trade union is taking a platform, there's an expectation with regard to the increment of wages. But unfortunately for now, let me just relate to the issues. We'll come later at some point. Anyway, I'll just say that by the way. Because one person once asked, what do trade unions have to do with the field as academic as international? Because their duty is the bargaining chamber. In one forum when we were presenting. Anyway, the bargaining chamber has become a universal and international context. So we must relate to it as a universal field. So I was just saying, by the way, but let me come back to the critical issues. Before we get to the core of what we want to relate to, I wanted to particularly raise a few issues. The first issue is, in many instances we take for granted that we all are at one about the meaning of national interest. And in many instances, or more often than not, the practice dictates to us the opposite of our assumptions. For instance, let me make an example about how dangerous and undefined national interest can be. In the U.S., when you talk about national interest, we are referring to the naked corporatist agenda of greed, and the epitome of which is the Bush regime, the Reagan regime, and so on and so forth. You may have moderate elements of it,
But the principal anchor of the U.S. foreign policy, what they define as U.S. national interest, is profit, profit, and profit. Human life, if it happens to be preserved in search for profit, all is fine. But principally, nothing must stand in the way of profit. And that is what they define as national interest. So that is why we must be very clear, without any absolute, without any amount of doubt, without the slightest of doubt, that what we define as national interest, which we presume is referring to the expansion of our value base beyond the borders of our own country, it's very critical that we all almost agree. That's why the questions about how our corporations behave elsewhere has an impact on the kind of foreign policy objectives we are seen to be pursuing. Not what we are pursuing, we are seen to be pursuing. Because what matters is that we must also be evaluated against our own intentions. Not long ago, one of the main problems that we are facing as a trade union, not as government, as a trade union, not long ago, we were in Ivory Coast, in an African trade union meeting of the West. They say to us, you South Africans, they refer to a COSATU delegation, you South Africans, under the pretext of claiming we are making peace, you are pursuing your own interests, you are putting up all the shops everywhere. We are seeing the emergence of your own, and they are exploiting us more than even you can imagine. Yes, you are telling us that you are exporting democracy. Not long ago, ESCOM workers from Senegal are writing us about certain problems that they are having. So the point of the matter is, the good intentions that we have of establishing democracy and advancing peace on the continent are not measured against our intentions. They are measured against what ultimately unfolds in the concrete field of practice. And in many instances, they regard us as part of government. Whatever the reason, I will not get into that. So that's why I was saying we cannot take for granted the essence of discussion about what is this national interest and to what extent are other players affecting or diluting or eroding the moral basis of our national interest in a very village. Because for instance, when a South African corporation goes elsewhere, people say it's South Africa. They don't say it's Pick and Pay, they don't say it's a ESCOM or whatever. They say it's South Africa. That is one point that we wanted to relate. But the second thing is, fundamental or central to the principle of our foreign policy should be the question of the eradication of poverty and job creation all over the world, creation of decent work and so on and so forth. We cannot assume it's inbuilt or it's automatic. It must be a conscious process to assess it. That poverty eradication, particularly because we also come from a continent which is very marginal in the world, which in terms of economic relations, is very insignificant, so-called, though we know that in relation to natural or primary resources, it's a very rich and well-endowed continent. So those are some of the things that we must be able to accept certain profound statements. Then I think we cannot avoid coming to the debate about the African agenda. It's very critical. And it's very key that the two speakers primarily anchor their relation to. And of course, the South African government has been able to assert an openly African agenda, an openly Africanist agenda, let me say, not Africanist in the other continent, but I'm just saying an agenda anchored in the interest of Africa. But probably, we need to take a step back and ask ourselves, what is the African agenda? In many instances, the assumption about African agenda carries with it various contradictions to many other commentators and speakers. But I think for our purposes, we must relate to two elements. What institutional form should the African agenda take? We have already related to it. When the ONU was established, it had to have institutional mechanisms. Pan-African Women's Organization, Pan-African Youth Movement, OATW, Organization of African Trade Union. It was part of the momentum to sustain and leverage institutionally. So we have seen the establishment of the AU and the African Renaissance Agenda. But probably we need to define the clear vehicles towards this realization. Institutionally, Then substantively, what makes an African agenda an African agenda? Separate from other agendas. Substantive. In other words, is it because it's all this loyalty to Africa? Is it because everyone who's in Africa is loyal to the African interest and the African agenda? Is it because anyone, wherever he or she happens to be, who's loyal to Africa's development is part of that African agenda? What is the actual definition in substantive terms of the African agenda? So that we can be able to measure it against our particular intentions. In this way, we must be able to answer a few questions. The first one is that, how do we consolidate regional democracy? Let me come back to our own region, Southern Africa. Do we consolidate regional democracy, particularly because it's critical to South Africa, because this is a springboard. And you may remember that Southern Africa, or SADC, is the only region that, in relative terms, has enjoyed a higher level and a higher degree of harmony in relative terms. Harmony and almost forward movement in terms of interaction. You see, the complexities in the other regions are very fluid. But with regard to our situation, the momentum is very high. So the process of consolidating democracy is even higher here. I know the Honorable Mr. Tole related to something that he said we are sharing in common with the DA with regard to Zimbabwe and so on and so forth. But I think one thing that is critical is that we will all agree that the consolidation of democracy in the region has a lot to do with our own national situation. For instance, let's make an example that Swaziland and Zimbabwe, for us of COSATU, have stood out in the region as the key areas of focus. Not only because certain other forces elsewhere, because I don't doubt the fact that there are forces that have got their own interests in Zimbabwe or wherever. There's no doubt about it. It's not a secret yet. But the primary anchor is for our own interest and consolidation of democracy and stability in the region. And also to unleash the massive potential, particularly because Zimbabwe is one of the well-endowed countries in the region, including Swaziland, however small Swaziland could be. So the most critical anchor is that we may need to define in very clear terms how do we relate to this situation that they don't begin to boil over to the extent that other countries in Central Africa particularly had to complicate regional dynamics. So I think that is one particular area, the consolidation of democracy in SADC. We are not saying these are the only countries that have challenges in Southern Africa, but principally for now, they need particular attention. The second one is, as we advance the African agenda, how do we promote non-military forms of peace building? Because the assumption is that whenever you talk about peace, it must only be the army. The question of peace building is very complex. For instance, we've been grappling with what is the role of trade unionists in building peace in Somalia? Should they be passive objects of state actors who come in and out and who fight their interests? Because the U.S. has got its own interests in Somalia and it's complicating the matters in that particular region, and other countries have got their. But what is the role of workers of Somalia in the building of peace in that country and development? That is the other question. But lastly, we certainly have the only remaining colony in Africa, Western Sahara. Yesterday we had a meeting about Western Sahara because the momentum must be generated sustainably. I think we need more than just South Africa, because it's very appreciable that South Africa has formally granted status, ambassadorial status to Western Sahara. I think it's a step ahead. What we need to do, how do we collectively advance an African agenda that affects the importance of Western Sahara self-determination? Those are the points that we wanted to relate to on the African agenda. I think we've related to the infrastructure and institutional capacity and the creation of momentum that will allow civil society to participate. I don't have to take long. I want to relate to two points before I come to the conclusion, or to the last point, which is the anchor of our input. The South-South agenda. There are many questions that come to mind whenever we talk about the South-South agenda. There is a non-aligned movement. There is a G77. Now there is an emergence of ISRA and other blocs could talk about even some of the G20 and so on and so forth, G23 and so on. So the critical point is, how do we synergize and maximize our impact or reconfigure these forces in such a way that they will be able to maximize our leverage globally? Because certainly the assumption about the South-South agenda is to develop a counter leverage, or to develop a leverage that will be able to counter the powerful forces in the world that think that can unilaterally impose their own interests all over the world. So to assert our agenda, how do we do that? But the other thing that can be questioned is, if the EU has got strategic partnership with about only 600, is it 600? EU, strategic partnership, I think there are only 600, no? Six blocks, something. Yeah, there are about six. And now it's pursuing a strategic partnership with South Africa. In practical terms, what does that mean for the South-South agenda and for South-South solidarity? What will be the view of the other, for the other forces? Because the same thing that we relate to either Nigeria as being inconsistent in other countries with regard to representing, and China too, with regard to asserting South-South interests, is the same thing that at some point also comes back to us in many forums. I remember that there was a forum globally, I forgot whether it was Food and Nutrition Global, where it was said that South Africa stood against an African agenda, but I was not part of that meeting. Anyway, so that's the submission that we got from the people, from those who went there, about the fact that there was a complaint from other activists that South Africa government was against the rest of Africa because it's interesting and the EU is one of them. I don't know if you can use your complexes, there could be debate. But the principal point is, yes, it would be important to pursue strategic partnerships that are in our national interest. But what do they mean for the fact that we are supposed to be the moral authority or moral representative of a particular agenda? And that agenda is the South-South agenda. A conscious agenda to be the moral representative and a moral custodian of the interests of the South, who can speak in confidence in international forums about the issues of the South that others cannot feel confident to speak about. What will be the impact on our moral authority to do so with regard to this? But the second thing that is critical is this one, is that is the consistency with regard to the South-South agenda. It's very difficult to be consistent in an inconsistent world. That is very true. Because interest remains the forbearer of whatever issue. So we need to create the momentum and relate to all the institutions in such a way that we can be able to sustain the momentum. I think the other question is the critical issue of the transformation of global governance. Multilateral or otherwise. In many instances, one question that has been asked is, there are uncomfortable questions that we may have not asked, some of them we may have asked. Some of these uncomfortable questions relate to, by the way, if you pursue, I think one speaker, I forgot whether it was one of the speakers on the podium, or one of the honorable members who asked that question. It was a question related to the fact that when we pursue the agenda against international terrorism, essentially and substantively, what are we referring to? Because probably we can pose the question the other way. Who has the authority or the sole right to be the monopolist of nuclear power in the world? Those are difficult questions, I know. But that's why we term them the uncomfortable questions. But they must still be asked. Because otherwise we have a world whose priorities are so warped and distorted that they turn us around. So it's not wrong to pursue the fight against terrorism as a principle. It's not. I think that must be emphasized. But essentially and substantive, at what level and how do we do that is a question that you probably may need to ask. And then also the question of the IMF as regards to the transformation of global governance. I know these days it has been really with the controversies surrounding its chief work of it. But the question that we should ask is that other countries who have said that they have completed their dues to the IMF, Venezuela, whether it was Mexico, and so on and so forth, have started the process of disengaging from the IMF. I'm not sure whether we should not be able to use that momentum and opportunity to be able to drive an agenda that would be able to pin down the IMF and demand a development institution, finance institution in the world. Because you see, the problem is that so long as we don't have the infrastructure globally that is sustaining development, we will not be able to pursue our development agenda. And this is the momentum that we require and the space that we require to pin down on the IMF and demand a development finance institution. That will play the Marshall role or the role of the Marshall Plan in Europe. Of course, it has a particular interest in Africa to provide the necessary resources for development. Those are some of the critical questions that we say, probably let's provoke them without necessarily expecting that we might exhaust them here. But it was critical. Let me get to the last point of question without wasting much of your time. The question of how the civil society and international relations. Having said all the above, and not substituting the very important points raised by the two previous speakers and members, and honorable members of the House, I want to relate to a few points with regard to other civil society. The first question is, what is the actual consistent and sustained relationship between civil society, the Department of Foreign Affairs, and the Portfolio Committee? Do we meet only when we meet in Geneva, or when we meet in Italy in the World Food Summit, or wherever we meet? And in that instance, we only meet or at the WTO negotiation when we have conflicting views, and then the South African delegation must gather together to be able to work out an emergency plan of how to be able to interact together and synergize our various points. Do we only meet at that level? I am sure that I'm not seeking to use this example to illustrate a wrong point. But let me make this example. The way civil society plays in Europe for the West plays a critical role as an instrument of foreign policy of the West cannot be undermined. I want to make an example. The church, without any offense meant, the church, there is documented evidence about the fact that wherever there is a political mission of the West, the church is the front runner, without approach. When the West was fighting the East over the so-called communism war, the Roman Catholic, particularly the Pope, was very in the forefront of the offensive. In fact, at some point there was found to be a synergy between the intelligence operatives and the church itself. Not only the church, the trade union. If we want to meet and discuss about negotiations with our counterparts from the north, they are very unapologetic about defending their interests. This so-called solidarity between us and them becomes secondary. So institutions of the north, including non-state actors, are very critical in influencing the world about the policies of their own countries. I am not seeking that to say that we must turn civil society into an instrument of the South African government. But I'm saying there are many areas of convergence. And in those areas, there is no need for conflict. And there is no need for disagreement. We need to harmonize and emphasize on those absolute areas. I think Dr. Samana emphasized on that point of understanding so that we are able to strike very important balances and synergy. For instance, South Africa is leading the number 11 countries in the WTO negotiations. And as COSATU, we support that. Because we said, if we allow further concessions in the WTO negotiations than has happened so far, there will be no prospect for industrialization in Africa. So therefore, South Africa's role in being a NAMA leader is very critical. And we do agree with that. But at what level does the Department of Trade and Industry interact with us, or civil society in general, to synergize positions? We have had various meetings with trade unions, African trade unions, South trade unions, and even North countries. We met with the Germans and the British because the Germans are taking over the EU president. And we met with that on these matters of trade. So the most critical point is we must be able to find synergies and emphasize on those synergies. So that's why we say that the role of civil society and government or institutions of the state must not be at a level where there are areas of conflict or when you meet in international forum. There must be consistent interaction. That's the first one. The second one is, how does the state support the role of civil society institutions that are playing a progressive role internationally? If, for instance, we say you want to resolve the question in Sudan, and you want the involvement of the people of Sudan, not as received as recipient or passive recipient of benevolence or state charity, but as active participants in their own development in Sudan. It means that the trade union, NGOs, and all civil society must be mobilized to defend the peace in Sudan. And who does that? It can't be the state. It can only be civil society workers. Because they also have a leeway to do certain things that the state can't do. So in that way, even the difficulties we may have in resolving conflict in various areas will be better leveraged by civil society that is active. But how does it get supported by the state to pursue that matter? Because the European Union, European organizations have got a state funding to pursue international work. They receive money from the state to pursue international work. So in that way, they can be able to pursue a particular agenda. So when we have a national agenda that we all have agreed upon, defend democracy, defend human rights, defend peace, build development in Africa, and we all agree that we must rally behind that agenda. But how? What kind of institutional capacity is required for us to make that up as a civil society? As I said, that there are two last points. The last point that I want to get to now is the Foreign Service Institute, which is critical also for us. I think I think it must be appreciated that the government has taken a step in that direction, and it must be very welcome, because it's a very critical factor that the extent to which we attach value to international work could be symbolized by the extent to which we are ready to take it up. Without substituting the important words that have been raised with regard to the limitations of the FSI, and also to say that we also agree with those important interventions with regard to what should be done with the FSI. But by the way, we as civil society, particularly us in COSATU, we've not had the privilege of getting an actual briefing on that particular matter, so we've only read about it elsewhere. So you might forgive us that in certain areas we might reflect particular inaccuracies. But to that extent, our intention is how do we interact with such an important initiative and how do we relate to it. So I think there are in our 3-year program, because we've got cyclical programs at the Federation. In our 3-year program, we've got what we call of international program. We've got what we call broadening the human resource base of our international work. But also, there's what we call international practitioner support and development program. That means to build the capacity of all people who do international work in COSATU and its affiliates. Let me show the significance of a trade union movement or civil society in the particular area, particularly South Africa. I want to be specific. International trade centers or secretariats, that means the international unions that are in particular sectors, a majority of them now are led by South Africans. And those South Africans are from COSATU Union, majority of them. ITEM, the international union that deals with energy and chemicals, is led by the NUM. The president of the world ITEM is from the National Union of Mine Workers. Education International, Teachers Internationally, which is the second biggest trade secretariat, is led by SAT, the Teachers Union. Comrade Tillas is the president. Comrade Senzen is the one who is the president of ICAM. ICF, International Trade Federation, International Transport Federation, Workers Federation, is led by SATAO, the General Secretary Comrade Randall Howard. I can mention a lot of others. 2009, we are holding for the first time in Africa International Congress of Nurses. South Africa has become a critical center for the international trade union movement. And the leadership of South Africa imposes particular responsibilities on COSATU, and South Africa is a country. And what does that say to us? Let me make an example. When South Africa was lobbying for the 2010, certainly our positions were very critical for our lobbying. And also, whatever else we want to advance internationally, we've got an already created platform of workers in the world who are organized and already available at our disposal.
So that means you must build the capacity to serve in this institution so that the leadership of the South African trade union movement is not doubted. Because it's not only about the South African trade union movement, it's about South Africans. This is giving credit, this is giving credit and confidence to South Africa as a country. And the fact that it has made advances. So this is important to be appreciated and be taken in that particular context. So that's why we say we need to create the momentum and leverage that will be able. COSATU is also a leading member of the board, the international board of the newly constituted International Trade Union Confederation, which is the amalgamation of the ICFTU, formerly ICFTU, and the WCL. So they, in last year in the Congress, they met together to form ITUC, International Trade Union Confederation. COSATU is in the board of that. These are very key organs that play a role, not only in the international trade, but also in the United Nations and in other multilateral institutions. So that's why I think we might not have realized that we have such an opportunity at our disposal that we have not been able to take advantage of. I do not count the other regional leadership roles and so on and so forth that we have. As we talk now, there's a general council that is taking place next week in Libya but one of the Northern African countries. And certainly South Africa is the vice president of OASU. And the question that is being asked, what agenda other than sitting in those meetings are we advancing? And how does that agenda advance South Africa's agenda? And how does it advance the agenda of the poor of Durban? Those are the critical questions that we say are very critical. So the human resource base seeks to say we want to build capacity of our international practitioners. So that you don't just have international officers or protocol officers. You take people to the airport and from the airport, you take them to Hector Peterson Square. From Hector Peterson Square, you take them to Zule and so on and so forth. That is not international work. That is protocol work. That is an element of international work. But fundamental international work is about a conscious, aggressive, and assertive agenda to change the world. And with those few words, Chairperson, I want to say thank you for the opportunity again for having been able to interact. But I did not present the whole program. All I was doing was to be able to reflect on the issues that we regarded as the hotspots of our engagement internationally.
Honourable members, I want to open this for us to interact with. What just towards the end. So raises very critical thing. How do we pull all our resources, wherever they are, as South Africans, to make sure that the message we communicate is a message that in all our different work is reflecting the country's policy. Members will remember that when we had a meeting with business, Dr. Mampai raised a very critical thing there to say we should look at the possibility where we get a situation where business and the Minister of Foreign Affairs sit together and that they get the briefing as business as to what are priorities of for that year or for the next 2 years, for the next 5 years, so that as they decide their own investment options, they need to make sure that they do that within and they carry the same message in doing that. And in saying so, he went further and said, we should come and see how, in the establishment of the smelter, how did they interact with the community there in building a process where community participation becomes important in that investment. Now, what I hear today is that you have your own trade union movement that engages in this international forum. The question that then remains is how then do we, without of course agreeing with Mr. Masuku when he says, without of course saying these institutions must become mouthpiece, but pulling this institution that the message we carry as South Africans is a message that can indicate that we all belong in the same country and we all have one objective that we pursue as a country. And how then do we balance that out in the situation? I attended a conference sometime in Nigeria, and there were scholars from South Africa. And listening to them, until I was told that they are from South Africa, I was shocked that we are coming from the same country.
because they saw a different South Africa, the one that I came from. And only when we were engaging and somebody said, I was with the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs, and somebody said, are you aware that guys, this is a professor from the UCT? I said, oh, he's from home. He said, yeah, okay. Because what was advancing in that was basically a different situation. So the question that comes to this portfolio committee is, how then do we position ourselves in such a way that while our constitutional mandate is to do an oversight over the department and the ministry, but we are able to assist them to coordinate with all other entities that play a role in the international community? How do we broaden our own scope to engage these entities to make sure that all of us, we create a space for them for debate? So I think Parliament should do that. The current theme of Parliament says that must Julian and more. So meaning that we need to create space for those debates to happen. How then is this portfolio committee playing that facilitating role to create different entities to engage not only with us, but with the South African public out there, and be able to do what it has been raised, I think, by Dr. Zondi, that the Department of Foreign Affairs does not communicate with the public out there. We only had one in Bizo, and I think that was very important. How then do we increase that engagement? How do we make this portfolio committee to provide that platform for the department to engage on policy issues and clarifying issues? A number of people have raised issues of Myanmar, our vote today. Have we been able to explain why did we vote in the particular way that we voted? What is it that was important for us to take that particular objective? And why do we vote in a particular way? And so I should raise Zimbabwe and Swaziland. It comes back to the same question. They're in the same custom union. They're in our region. To what extent really do we pursue the question of the African agenda in such a way that we advance the interests of peace and democracy and making sure that Swaziland changes? How do we ensure that we use our own development to benefit the future on one hand? Is it in the interest of South Africa to have Lesotho remaining where it is? Or is it in our interest to move Lesotho and develop to a particular level? I'm aware that when this question was raised in the last briefing, we were told that is it the UN instruments that have been used to classify countries? But these are the same instruments that are used to classify South Africa. And this will be the same instrument that will be used if South Africa makes a decisive intervention to develop the Lesotho from where it is to be a better country. So it's not an instrument used, but it's what do we do as South Africans to pull the Lesotho along. And therefore the leadership that we talk about, I think it's a leadership that we need to be seen, that has been raised, that we tend to raise or concentrate on issues of political emphasis, place political emphasis, but we are not prepared to follow it up. I think that Landsberg raised the fact that is our commitment in line with the resources we allocate? Are we allocating the necessary resources to see through our foreign
Thank you. how do we lead the two organizations and ourselves to society to do that? And what message are you actually carrying to do that? Because when you look at doing that in South Africa, you find a lot of contradictions in terms of where we go.
Thank you. I love the company.